So I'm going to talk about evolution dynamics with multiple beneficial mutations, and mostly I'm going to talk about very simple models, but which I think are somewhat instructive. Initially asexual, and this is very close to Joachim's talk of the day, and then I'm a bit on sexual things and spatial things. Actually, I think the first time I ever met David Gross, he started off the talk by saying, in the 3 hours allotted to me. So, no. But we'll get to lunch. Oh, okay. This is even better. Okay. There's also no limits on at what point the audience can start walking out or falling asleep or anything. Right? That's the rule. And there's cleverly arranged back doors of various kinds. So okay. But I want to just start off by something which is, you know, a bit more philosophical in some sense. But I found amazingly few things in the literature on this, and not many things that get mentioned. And that is a question: if one's trying to understand evolution, what numbers matter? Okay. So I'm just going to write down some numbers. So one of the ones which obviously matters for some things, which is just say the number of base pairs in a genome. And this varies, I guess, from about 10 to the 5th to 10 to the 11th, if I exclude viruses. So that's one number that obviously matters. Another number that matters is the mutation rate per base pair, which is generally around 10 to the minus 9. I mean, there's some variation, but compared to the orders of magnitude variation, these various other things, that variation is pretty small. Another one, which of course we heard a lot of discussion in here, is some population size, and obviously that depends a lot on the population size in terms of number of individuals. That's an important one. One which also we heard a bit of about here, but not so much, is if I look at the size of the selective advantage for beneficial mutations or deleterious mutations, and I guess one I've heard numbers used as small as 10 to the minus 6 to numbers of order 1, where things can just divide much faster than their competitors. Certainly by the time one's talking about sex, one ought to have the recombination rate various measures of it, which I guess goes sort of up to 1 of where really, or 10, if you look at the number of recombinations per generation, 10 squared, down to 10 to the minus for various bacteria that only have sex or recombination very, very rarely. Some of it often, some very rarely. So that's one where I think the range of the numbers is not really known. Okay. So, you know, which of these numbers matter depending on the context? Okay. So if we think of this in terms of...
What does it mean for that to be bigger than 1?
Sorry?
What does it mean for that to be bigger than
1? Well, just the number of recombination events per generation. Right, so there's several per chromosome, so that's on the order of 100. And it depends. I mean, I could call it 1. It depends on what I mean by it. At this level of putting up the numbers, all the numbers only make sense to log accuracy, as in some of the ones I'll write down soon, even more so. So.
And do I read that right? You wrote 10 to the minus 22?
No, 10 to the minus question mark. Oh. Well, okay, we'll put 10 to the minus... let's see. We'll put 10 to the minus 8. I don't know. I mean, some bacteria, there's no evidence they have it over very long time scales, and I don't know.
I think it's much lower in E. coli.
Hmm?
I think it's much lower in E. coli.
Yeah, it probably should be more than this, okay. I intended, okay, but this is getting to the kind of thing is this, even getting at some of those numbers, that some of those aren't in the literature. If we think in terms of time scales, there's 1 over, obviously coming from this, there's 1 over the mutation rate, so this is the turnover time for a typical mutation, and that's enormous, right? That's already getting close to the age of life on Earth, because the numbers are so low. So that time scale is very slow. So this is sort of turnover, some turnover time. Then there's n, which is the drift time for neutral variation. Then obviously 1 over s and 1 over r are our time scale as well. And then we've got, if we sort of think of bigger numbers, obviously we've got the lifetime, these are units of generations mostly. We've got lifetime, we've got the age of the species, species, considering the age of life on Earth, the lifetime of the experiment, whatever thing one is going to look at. Okay. Now, again, these numbers vary all over the place. This is very long. Okay. This is very long. You know, these ones are not necessarily very long or short. This is very long. And one of the things I have, there's not been much mentioned, I think Marty mentioned it, since these are the two which are emphasized in neutral theory, then the mu n is the combination which tends to come in there. But something which often gets forgotten is the time scale to establish the sort of steady state that people talk about. That time scale is of order n. Okay, which is not that ridiculously large for sort of effective populations for humans, but as Marty pointed out, for Drosophila is already way bigger than any time scale which is involved in the lifetime of the species. Okay, so one has to start questioning what exactly is one doing when one's, you know, using N for this, and certainly by the time you talk about bacteria, is much, much bigger than that still. Okay, so the neutral theory tends to emphasize those. If I look at sort of macroscopic theory of evolution and so on, then the things that tend to get emphasized are this one, the 1 over S, maybe recombination rates, but particularly the 1 over S and the, you know, all these ones down here, the characteristic times. Okay. And you notice this is a non-overlapping set. Okay. And it seems to me the fact that this is a non-overlapping set is one of the intrinsic difficulties with the field. It is not at all clear what combinations of numbers matter for evolution dynamics, either on short time scales, you know, things you can really do experiments, or on you know, enormously long on long time scales. Okay. Now I'm just going to read two quotes from. Related to biology. So one of these is from Rich Lenski, who has done the sort of longest series and nicest evolution experiments in microbes. And I think, I don't know, half the people who are doing evolution experiments in the country are probably descendants of Rich Lenski's. And he's actually, this is a review of Ernst Mayr, who's a great evolutionary biologist who died a couple of years ago at age 100 or something like that. And he's a review of Mayr's last book. And he says that Mayr argues that the kind of precise mathematics and the kind of analysis that underline physics are just not applicable for evolution. And basically then Mayr argues that one should divide biology into the historical parts and the functional parts, and none the twain shall meet. And Rich ends the review by saying that arguing for the distinction between the functional and historical domains of biology, of biological understanding, may reflect a limited interest in evolutionary dynamics per se. Okay. So that's on one side, and the other, one of the big popularizers of evolution, Richard Dawkins, one of my favorite straw men. This is actually from a commentary in Nature from about 10, 15 years ago about a paper which was entitled "Estimation of the Time to Evolve a Vertebrate Eye." Okay. And so Dawkins was writing this little commentary, and which he ended by saying that this should still Darwin's shudder. He should no longer have to roll over in his grave, because now this was so clearly understood, and in fact it was an extremely short time scale, this estimate. Okay. Nowhere in this estimate do the size of the population or mutation rates or anything like that ever enter. Okay, it's entirely phenotypic selection using the some selective advantage. Nowhere to N or mu enter. Yeah.
Yeah, and something that we really want to discuss in the whole course, I don't think, is the the ecological time scale
right.
In which things happen. Although actually, Luca did. I mean, if you're interested in, you know, the evolution of viruses or frequency changes, you know, in viruses, then there's kind of an epidemiological time scale. That might be a couple of years, but
right.
You know, how fast does the environment change?
Right. So there's actually, this is one of the things I mentioned, so thanks, Marty. One of these is sort of mixing times, how long the changes take to get around the Earth or to get around some region. All populations are not well mixed. And the other one, of course, is time scales for environmental variation. Now, in some sense, these time scales are everything. I mean, everything from short to very long, and all sorts of numbers come in there. Okay. Anyway, so in this commentary of Dawkins, so he this still himself, but he starts with this little commentary by saying that his reaction to physicists and mathematicians and things who, you know, say they're puzzled about how evolution proceeds so fast and why there's so much diversity and so on, and he calls this argument from personal incredulity. Okay, But I say Dawkins, there is nothing on any numbers anywhere except for these, and say those totally, you know, ignore the fact that you need mutations and things for evolution to proceed. Okay. So the crucial question is, which of these numbers matter? Okay. Now these numbers, I'm going to put down some ones which are ridiculously large. So most evolution ever was carried out by bacteria and archaea, and you know, multi-cell organisms, sort of, and eukaryotes are sort of on top of that. They invented a few extra things, but certainly as far as sort of in some sense that the evolution potential and the really development of cells and things was done early on. Okay. So we can ask, what are the relevant timescales for that? Okay. So one of the things that one can numbers. Is okay. So what is obviously the total time in generations? So the total time of life, bacterial life in generations. Okay, well that depends on how long you think an average bacterial generation is. Estimates are actually about once a year. You think of E. coli being once every 1,000 seconds, 20 minutes, but in fact it's once a day, typical turnover. So this sort of varies. If you look at total number of generations, sort of typical bacteria maybe varies in the from the say 10^9 to 10^12, if you really want to be optimistic, in the whole lifetime. Okay, that's a big number. Okay, and the typical thing that is always emphasized in evolution is the fact that the time is very big. Okay. Now, I've asked various evolutionary biologists I've talked to, is I said, look, supposing, until very recently when there were mutational clocks, the only evidence for that, the timescales, data on timescales, came from, you know, geophysics and radiochemistry. Okay, and I said, well, supposing the geochemists and the geophysicists and the radiochemists came to the biologists and said, look, we really screwed up. We made a sort of NASA-style error. And really, life's 10 to the 100th years old instead of 10 to the 10th. Would it bother anyone? I mean, and the answer I got from people who've thought about things said no. The lack of understanding of quantitative things is in the errors by factor 2 in the log, right? Or even the triple log. Now then I say, what about 10 to the 10 to the 10th? Okay, now 10 to the 10 to the 10th should bother one. I mean, if you start estimating really rare things happening spontaneously, so that's a big number. Okay, so this is a big number, but there's another one which is the total number of bacteria on Earth. Does anyone know how big this is? Do you know, or that's a guess? Anyone who knows some biology, take a guess? Nobody? I think David was cheating. No? Okay. It's an enormous number. I mean, so the numbers, the estimates are around 10 to the 31. Okay. So David, being a string theorist, you see, is used to ridiculously big numbers. Okay.
Marty's estimate of the number of E. coli.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is a very large number.
31 bacteria.
Sorry?
What's the mass of 10 to the 31
bacteria? Okay, if you cover the whole Earth, if you cover the whole Earth, it fills up a layer about 10 to the 10 centimeters thick. Okay, that ballpark.
That's like meters or kilometers in the ocean floor.
So the estimates are that it's actually dominated by deep ocean and deep earth bacteria. So this one is probably an upper bound, could be two orders of magnitude smaller. Certainly it's not enormously smaller than that. Okay. So if I just multiply these together, that's the number of evolution experiments I've ever performed by bacteria. So if I look at the total number times, if I call this the time, the total number times time, I mean, if I think of being relatively conservative, it's about 10 to the 40 plus or minus 2. And if I look at the, just a nice number, is that e to the 10 to the 43 is e to the 100. Okay, so if you like natural log, there's a nice number to remember, is about e to the 100. Okay, and you notice that if I look on a log scale, right, 3/4 of the big number comes from this, and only 1/4 of it from that. Okay, but is this a relevant number? Okay, if one assumes that there are interesting things that happen are sort of mutation limited, and so it really is the number of experiments, then this number times mutation rates times genome size and things like that, and this is the relevant number. Okay, but again, a question I've asked people, I said, supposing the Earth was 1,000 times as small, but with similar diversity of environments, okay, would the diversity we got so far take 1,000 times as long? And vice versa, if it was much bigger, would it take much less? Again, I haven't found, and no one's pointed to me the literature where the sort of questions are asked and thought through. Some of these things are in, if you go to divinity school libraries, you find some of these questions asked more. And I think it's a pity that that they've got such a bad name, I mean, deservedly such a bad name, these things in the library, that people maybe have turned off from asking some of the questions. So there's a okay, so this is questions of big numbers, but unfortunately, even for small things that you can do in experiments in the lab, so I mean Rich Lenski's experiment and so on, and asking what combinations of things matter there. You know, would things have changed if you did lots of smaller experiments, if they were much longer time but smaller populations, if the mutation rates were factors of 100 larger, which they actually are in some of the situations there. And you know, what happens on reasonable timescales in which you can do experiments? Okay. And where you can see things like evolving of viruses in or bacteria for pathogens and things that people, you know, are really starting to follow now. So that's motivation about worrying about numbers. Now, I say the basic problem is something which, you know, in physics, a lot of aspects of this were solved centuries ago even, where of understanding what combinations of numbers come in so that you can try to do extrapolation. I mean, and it's even extrapolating from simple things. Like things that go in lab or things that you can do to drive things strongly compared to things that happen in hospitals or trying to get some estimates of anything. And for that, you at least need to know what combinations of parameters come in. And these numbers, say, are enormous. And even numbers that come in the, you know, experimental lab, or if you look at all the E. coli in your body over the time scale of that, if you look at all E. coli in the world in humans, all E. coli in humans over the time scale of medicine, you know, which is a very relevant number, okay, that's enough that all simultaneous three-point mutations, simultaneous same generation, have occurred. Maybe slightly less than all, but a very significant fraction of them. Okay, so that's a sort of, you know, scale of how far can be explored easily in genome space. But that's not enormously far compared to the, you know, some of the big the big numbers. Okay, so I would be happy to understand anything to log accuracy, basically. I mean, you know, so this is pretty small error bars, but you know, understanding the difference between 10 to the 10th and 10 to the 100th for a lot of things would already be very useful. Okay, so that's the general bit. Now I can turn my microphone on. No, okay. So sort of comments on this. Does anyone know of literature which, you know, talks a bit about numbers and
I think there was a discussion of phages.
Hmm?
Yeah. Discussion of phages, one roughly has an idea of how many phages one finds.
Right. And, right. Which is similar to the number of bacteria. The same ballpark, I think.
Yeah, it's
yeah. Lot of yeah. Yeah. No, but with, you know, to this accuracy to log these, yeah, order a couple orders of magnitude larger. Phages are much smaller genomes and more is known, and phages are the one where there's already been substantial efforts in tracking the dynamics in real time, and so really coupling together the genomic changes and the phenotypic changes, and that's, I mean, starting to happen with bacteria, but there's not been many cases so far. But, you know, in the next 10 years, one can do a lot of that if there's effort put into interesting things on sequencing. So, okay.
It's certainly the case that the average phenotypic evolutionist, you're right, doesn't really worry about these things.
Yeah.
At least I can think of one specific instance where, you know, that time scale for evolutionary change was investigated, and that had to do with the issue of evolution of the human brain, because that's, you know, at times has been claimed to be a challenge to evolution, to produce such a large change in brain volume complexity in a short amount of time. And I do recall Russ Landy once, a very well-known quantitative geneticist, you know,
thinking about the number of mutations that seem to have caused it and various things.
Showed that, that, you know, under kind of standard assumptions of quantitative genetic models, it was quite easy for the brain to evolve as quickly as it did.
Because only a few mutations were involved.
No.
Basically, quantitative things like getting bigger is fast.
The decimal model was a large number of.
Yeah.
Genes. Well, like, and that was one of the questions, because there were some who were arguing that perhaps the only way the brain could have gotten so large so fast was through a couple of mutations, a very large effect. And he said, no, sort of the infinitesimal
Yeah. Yeah, so this is one of the big issues. Is it mostly from a lot of mutations to small effect, or is it what I've forgotten who invented the name, a lot of the interesting things in evolution happen via hopeful monsters, where there's something that happens of a very big effect, and then there are a whole lot of other mutations to sort of correct the damage that's done, and you know, the other side effects of that of those mutations. And of course, afterwards, looking at the genome, it's very hard to tell the difference between those two. Unless you get it pretty soon. So those kind of things are and people have done in particular context. These sort of quantitative things of going from something you've already got to something that's bigger or better from it. I mean, then it sort of seems the number of potentials are estimates. One wouldn't expect those times to be so long. The difficulty is going from things you don't have to things to other things, I mean, new things. Now, what does one mean by new? And typically, anytime anyone finds something new in an experiment, other people say, well, that doesn't really qualify as new, even though they would have qualified it as new before the experiment was done. And so there's a question, you know, what sort of things are significant evolution and what sort of things aren't, and that's obviously a matter of taste. But yeah.
The question of whether you can explore all the 1 and 2 point mutant neighbors of a sequence, I find that hard to interpret, given that the population is not all the same. If the population was identical, you could do what you just did, right? Yeah. Given that the population is spread out anyway, what does it mean to talk about all the 2 points?
No, it's just a comment that between the total collection of E. coli, that they've will have explored all those, right? And if those were big enough effect, that E. coli would have taken over the population.
So if you consider where all these E. coli are, they're spread out, and you haven't explored.
But E. coli between humans mix on time scales less than 30 years around the world. They certainly mix on time scales less than that.
No, I mean spread out in genotype.
Yeah.
Not spread out in space.
Yeah. So those mutations are on top of all the existing diversity, which is surely absolutely crucial. Right. So
you have another big number.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, 4 to the length of a genome.
Okay. So there's another number which I should have put down, which is if I look at this e to the 100, and I ask how long amino acid sequences have been fully explored. And the answers then is about 100. Okay, so it doesn't even constitute as a protein. I mean, roughly speaking, if really every time you made DNA, you explored something different, the maximum that could have been explored was all possible things of the length of a protein domain. So it's tiny, right? So that's an even bigger number. And that's why by the time you get 10 to the 10 to the 10th, you start saying about spontaneously producing 1,000, a million bases of DNA that's right and sticking it somewhere, right? So that's why, I mean, 10 to the 10 to the 10th numbers, one starts being a different than 10 to the 100, so on. But yeah, no, so I mean, So these big numbers, and I don't know which matter. Okay, so they're like going away from the interesting parts. So now's time to start napping. So let's try to really just ask that, you know, really in the simple models. And of course, we've heard a lot about models of a neutral variation, where an awful lot can be worked out. There is, you know, historically also an awful lot about where the single mutations coming in, and you know, somewhere where there's two. But by the time you've got many mutations coming in, there's again, I mean, very little literature even on the absolute simple models. So the other day we heard about some of those simple models, and I'm going to actually start with almost exactly the same model and talk about that, and then go to, I mean, much more limited things, talking about sex and so on within the model. Okay. So I want to start with something with as few parameters as possible, so one can try to understand it, but with the already having interesting things that can happen. And so I want a situation where life is extremely simple and totally unrealistic. And this is roughly speaking the one-dimensionalizing model of evolution dynamics. If I think of the population genetics with neutral variation as being like ideal gases, I mean, they're much harder than normal ideal gases, and this one-dimensionalizing model turns out to be much harder than one-dimensionalizing models normally are. Okay. So I want to first, let me just some notation, actually, because unfortunately I'll confuse myself if I try to use the same notation as used the other day. So I'm going to call phi the fitness, and I'm going to think of everything as being rates. So I'm going to think of being additive rather than multiplicative, but as long as changes in fitness are not large, it doesn't really matter. So this is going to be the fitness, say, of a particular organism with some genotype. And then phi bar, which of course, going to be time dependent, it's going to be the average fitness in the population. population which is competing with each other. N is going to be the population size. And I'm going to look at the simplest thing possible, ignore neutral variation for now, ignore deleterious mutation for now. And so I'm going to call M, which is sometimes called UB, which is the total beneficial mutation rate. So in the whole genome. Okay. And some other things will come in shortly. Okay, so those sort of parameters which are going to come in. Oh, and then S is going to be a selective advantage, but I'm going to initially consider several of those. So S is the changes in phi from mutations is S. Okay. So now I'm going to just take simple additive or multiplicative, assuming there's no interesting interactions between the genes. So phi is just if I have a bit string, 1, 0, 0s, 1s, and so on for the genome, then phi is just the sum on the selective advantage of each of these of Si times sigma I, where this is zeros or zeros or ones. Okay. And the simplest case of that is the simplest, okay, is to assume all the selective advantages are the same. Okay. So that's the simplest. And last time we heard about what happens is an exponential distribution of them, which also only has one parameter in it, but is much trickier to understand, and I can comment on that later. Okay. So we've got this parameter S, and then I'm going to assume that the number of sites is very large. So number of sites large, the number of beneficial sites is large, so that I can keep evolving for a long time. And of course, being physicists, in the model, we can take that to infinity. So what I'm talking about is going to be evolution on a fitness landscape. So this is, if I look at the fitness, and here I can then, of course, in this case here, just phi is then equal to S times the number of these beneficial mutations which have been acquired.
So why are you calling this an easing model? I mean, isn't this just spins, independent spins in random magnetic fields?
It's even easier, right. But it's dynamics of it. By one-dimensional easing model, I mean the most trivial model that has interactions in it, has something interesting in it, okay, which is going beyond an ideal guess.
But the interactions are not yet at the level of this fitness? Or?
No, I mean, they are. Things interact with each other because how you get from one to the next. I mean, they really do. If I think of it as like transformation, which I mean, it really is, you know, it's somewhat analogous. But that's it wasn't intended to be saying I can do it by the Ising model. Okay. I mean, when I first heard a talk on this, actually, by a physicist who was doing these complicated things and moment expansions and complicated numerics and things, and I said, this is ridiculous. I mean, this model is so simple, I want to be able to do it in a weekend. 5 years later, okay, with many too many weekends wasting time on trying to understand things, okay, I'm at least willing to give a talk on it. Yeah. So this is the landscape phi then, and so this is this number of beneficial mutations coming in here, and this is really just a staircase then. So it's a staircase, each one is an additional S, so this height is obviously S. And then I have mutation rate going from here to here, and that's a total mutation rate, so it's mu times the number of sites. And I say I'm ignoring deleterious mutations, I'm ignoring neutral, and I'm ignoring whatever the differences may be between the mutations here. I'm just counting them for counting the fitness. Okay. So the obvious thing that we would like to understand is how fast does this the evolution proceed up here, so it'll proceed up there, and the I'm going to call the speed at which it does that V. So V is going to be d phi bar of dt. Okay. Now phi bar is averaged over the specific population. So phi bar is a quantity which, you know, will vary from one experiment to another. But I want to know, you know, is there a typical value? What is the fluctuations in, and so on, in principle. Okay. So I want V going up like this. Okay, so this model then has three parameters, N, M, and S. Okay, but in fact it only has two because S basically just sets the time scale, 1 over S. So it's the time scale for a single beneficial mutant to grow by a factor of E in the population. That's basically the time scale, so I only have two parameters. Okay, and the conventional combinations that these come in as are N times M, which is the thing that comes in, in neutral cases, and N times N times S, which is telling me whether S is large and I have strong selection or not. Okay, so I'm going to look at cases where this is much larger than 1, So that's a strong selection. And I'm also going to look in the cases which are usually true except for viruses, where I'm going to look at S being much, much bigger than M. Okay, so I've got my three parameters, I'm in this range, and I have just the ratios in between them. Now, one of the immediate things is, in what combination did these parameters actually come in? I can make several combinations of the three of them. Okay, and I say the conventional thing is that this is going to be the one that's going to come in, and this will come in for some others. That just at the time scale. Okay, this is a sort of boring one, basically N. And this is an important one here because that's just the total rate of producing mutations in the population, beneficial mutations. Right? So that should be an important one. Okay, so already it'll turn out that's not quite right. That they actually come in different ways, which are not entirely obvious. Okay. So what do I want to do? Okay, just for the expert, I'm always going to treat the population size as being continuous, so it's like doing the diffusion approximation for all the different genotypes together. It's just easier than I can write down stochastic differential equations and analyze it by various means and so on. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about how to get the answers. I'm just going to give the heuristic arguments and then say what a few things are. Okay. So the first thing one could try to do, being a statistical mechanic, is to try to do sort of mean field theory. I've got very large numbers, even in experiments here. I want to be able to ignore fluctuations. So this is just ignoring fluctuations, which is like ignoring the discreteness of individuals and fluctuations that come from that. So if I do that, and I just write down the deterministic approximation to this, so then it's trivial to write down. So I just look at I have a variable n with a subscript which is, I guess the fitness, but I can call that x times s. I don't know, the fitness is an integer if I want to measure things in units of s. So this is the population size for that particular genome. It's the numbers of one here. Okay? And I want to look at how that evolves, and I particularly want to look at the speed v. Okay? So if you do this, what you conclude is that v is a function of t. It gets faster and faster. If I look at this, this goes exponentially. Okay? So it runs, starts going up the hill, gets faster and faster and faster, and goes exponentially fast. So no matter how high the hill is, it'll get to the top in a time which is logarithmic in the height of the hill, given the basic time scale S. I mean, the time scale m comes in as well, but sort of just cuts off a logarithm. Okay, so this is an intrinsic problem. It says you get it very fast. In fact, even if you put in dips in this here, if you put in dips in this and come back up again and dips to very far away mountains, it's always basically logarithmic. So, our genome could turn into something like that of a cockroach. It's much fitter in a time scale that's not very long. Okay, if you take this large n approximation, and you say, with numbers like 10 to the 31, you should be able to. Oh, I should mention the other big number is a nice one. If you're interested in vertebrate evolution, which a lot of people are rather than microbes, then the relevant number is Avogadro's number, which is at least, I haven't seen it in the literature, but it's a ballpark estimate for the total number of vertebrates ever. Okay, so that's a nice number, but it's enormous, right? So it's that's the analogy of this 10 to the 42nd or so on for bacteria.
Does variance and fitness blow up as you go to?
Yeah, so the variance blows up and you just get a very broad distribution. However, you can immediately go and figure out what the problem is. Okay, what is the problem with this? The problem with this is if I go up a very large number of steps, okay, and then I work backwards and sort of ask, when did the first individual arrive here? Whose population is going to grow exponentially and beat out all the populations further down, because this grows as a more rapid exponential, right? This grows as whatever it is, e to the 10s t relative to this one. And if the mean is still down here, it's going to go very fast. Okay. Oh, I should say, I'm sorry, I didn't say this. So this population, n phi, this will grow exponentially. It's competing with everyone else. So this grows exponentially at a rate e to the phi minus phi bar times t. Okay, so they're growing exponentially. If everything's moving up together, they're competing against each other, and this is deflecting the effects of the competition. Okay. And in a certain real sense, this is the interaction, is that phi, the fact that it's coupling via phi bar. So, it's a sort of mean field-like in a different sense than this.
Okay. So, I've been worrying about the difference between additive and multiplicative here.
No difference.
And you've defined it to be additive, but the point is now you've put the growth rate in the exponential anyway, so now you've made it multiplicative. Now you've confused me again.
1/generation time. Okay. So as long as my total, so I can do this. Let me write. Let me write the maximum of this at any time is less than the generation time. Okay, so the fitness differences are never large. I mean, I can do it if they're large and so on, but it just gets more complicated and so on.
The issue is whether this is going because you're going to have a finite width of distribution here to avoid these long tails, and so the issue is how much better is the next one relative to where you are now.
That's the five bar, right? So this is the five bar is where the average population is now. So if I have a distribution here, you know, I've got many of these, a few of these, some of these, and so on. These are mainly competing with this.
But doesn't it depend on phi minus 5R divided by 5R?
No, because phi minus 5R is always small. Okay, you can do it multiplicatively if you want. It just gets more complicated, and as long as the variance doesn't get too large, it doesn't change things much. If the variance gets very large, it makes things even worse. So, okay, I'm always in the limit where the total variations in the fitness are small compared to generation time. So it never grows very much per generation, and then the additive is identical to the multiplicative. What's normally called multiplicative.
So you always have to consider relative fitnesses.
Always going to be relevant. Otherwise, if I've gone all the way up here, then I agree with you. I can't do that. But as long as as any given time, no individual is that much fitter than anyone else, then it's fine.
So this comes about because one sort of assumes that all the mutations are already present at t equals zero.
No.
How does this exponential growth?
They come in very quickly. Right? You very quickly get some mutations here. You get some mutations there, and you get exponentially small number of mutations very quickly. So you get of order m here, m squared there, m cubed here, m to the fourth there, m to the tenth here, but then they grow exponentially. Okay. So what actually happens is if I look at the population here and ask sort of where did it first come from, you'll find that it involved exponentially small number of individuals, which means that no matter how big the population is, the number of individuals that effectively you're including here is extremely small. Okay. So this is nonsense. And I mean, and basically for almost any evolutionary process which involves getting from where you're increasing the fitness over the course of the dynamics, the infinite end limit is nonsense. I mean, you can ask, if it's big enough, you can ask how long does it break down for and so on.
How self-averaging is 5R?
Well, this is infinite n, so it's completely self-averaging.
Well, let's say n is finite. How much?
If n is finite, then v is very well self-averaging. In fact, there's very small fluctuations in v. Phi bar isn't. Phi bar is going to diffuse. Okay. So this is nonsense. So let's throw this away and ask what really happens. What really happens is there's some distribution on this picture.
Okay, no, but I get that this is nonsense. But if you want to have a finite n, you would.
I'll jump ahead, but I'll just say. So I get some distribution on this. Some distribution on this, that's going to move with V, an average V, and then it diffuses around. So it's basically a traveling wave moving with a speed V with some diffusion around that. Okay, and you can figure out, you can calculate the diffusion coefficient.
Okay. And it goes to zero as n gets big.
It goes to zero as n gets big, yes. Yeah. Rather slowly, but it does go to zero. So this is the infinite n limit, so that's nonsense in spite of the number of papers on it in the literature. Okay. So quasi-species theory is great if you're near a fitness peak. For getting from one fitness peak to one a substantial distance away, it tends to break down unless the other peak's very close. Okay. So what's the other limit? The other limit which is done is modest n. Okay. So what is modest n? Modest n is where nm is much less than 1. Okay, I'm still having n much bigger than 1 over s, but I, you know, with typical numbers, have a big range in between there. So nm is much less than 1. Let's see, what if I want to write this much bigger than m over s? Okay. S over m. Okay. nm is much less than 1. If nm is much less than 1, then what happens is each generation you're only likely to produce one new mutation, or many fewer per generation. So what happens then, if I look at the, now as a function of the phi here, so initially I've got one population, that's my whole population. So these are the n's. One population, then I get a mutation to the next one, so I start getting a little population here, I get one individual there, this then grows, this one comes down, and basically this takes over the population before anything else happens. Then I get another mutation coming here, that one grows, takes to the population. And most of the time it's unimodal. In between these it's bimodal, you have to be lucky to catch it in the middle of a sweep if n is large. And basically it goes up one step at a time. Okay, and I don't know, what's the conventional word for this? I don't like to call it sequential, but there's a...
I call it
periodic.
Periodic, okay. Okay, they're irregular, they're basically Poisson, Poisson distributed, and the rate is then very easy to work out. Okay, so what is the rate to work out? Well, the obvious factor is Nm, I need that. Okay, so Nm is the obvious number that comes in, the rate of producing mutations, but then there's another number which I need, which is for each mutation is produced. So I have one new mutation, okay, which has a fitness advantage just S, right, because the mean is basically the just one. One below in this case. So it's got a one fitness advantage S, and then I just need to know the probability of fixation. So usually that'll die out, but occasionally it'll fix. So this probability of fixation is proportional to S. Exactly what dynamics it is, normally it's written as 2S. In the simple dynamics I'm going to use is equal to S, but it doesn't matter much. You can put in the effects otherwise. Okay. So basically, very small effect mutation, it's likely to die out. And so if I look at the typical dynamics here, and so I look at the N of phi bar plus 1, the one that's coming in here, this will typically be nothing initially. Then I'll come along for a time. I'll come along for a time, which is order 1 over M, NM. Then I'll get 1, but that'll typically die out. I get another one that'll typically die out, another one typically die out. And then one will get lucky and take off. But only 1 over S of those takes off. So if I look at this total time here, this is 1 over NMS. Okay? So then what is V? So V then is just S times the rate of fixation of the new mutations. Right? So this is just then NMS squared. Okay? Which you saw the other day. In general, of course, the distribution would have an integral over this, over the distribution of S's. So this is the basic thing there, and it really, you know, the NM is what comes in here, and the S is just setting the time scales, and the fixation probability. Okay. So so this limit is very simple. Okay. So now we have to ask, when does this break down? So we've got low N, or modest N is very simple. Infinite N is nonsense, and so we've got everything in between. Okay. So we first want to ask, when does this break down? And again, this was about on Wednesday. So if you look at when does this break down, there's two time scales involved. There's this time scale here, which is 1 over n mu s. So 1 over nms is the time scale for the getting a successful mutant. So I'm going to call it, and this is, I don't know, it's not an entirely conventional word. I like this one. I'm going to call this that the mutant gets established. That's saying it gets big enough that it'll grow exponentially. So if it's little, it won't. If it gets big enough to grow exponentially, and it typically has to get big enough by an amount of order 1 over s. Once its population is much bigger than 1 over s, it'll grow exponentially. Okay, so this here will grow as e to the st, and of course eventually come up and saturate at n. Okay, so roughly speaking, this goes as 1 over s, e to the st, and this is after it's established. So if I say this is an establishment time, when it first comes in, it may not fix. It could go back down in the population again. So I don't want to use fixation. This is when it first comes into the population and it's going to take off. It's done well enough to take off. Okay. So I've got this here, and this is the typical time between establishments. Okay. And then I've got a time which is 1 over s, and there's a log ns here, which is the sweep time. Okay, so that's the time between the establishment time and the fixation time. So this is roughly T fixation minus T T establish. Okay, I mean up to factor of 2. So I've got these two numbers here. Obviously what this picture works is when new ones don't come in until previous ones fixed. So this limit here is where this time is much longer than that. Okay, so this calculation here with this value of V, when does this work? Okay, this works in the case where NM is much less than 1 over log S. S over N is actually, you can write in this form as useful. Okay. So basically NM is small compared to 1, but logs tend to matter in this. They can be big factors, and as we see, they're rather crucial factors coming in. So this is the condition. Now, if you put in microbes, it obviously depends on what M is, but you can get into this regime with, you know, 10 to the fourth a bacteria easily. Okay, even in boring environments, you know, by the time you get to 10 to the fifth, 10 to the fifth, or yeast, which probably aren't as clever as bacteria and mutations, you get into this regime very quickly. Okay, in fact, it's quite hard people know this who do experiments of certain things, if you want to avoid having mutations coming in which are beneficial in doing things, you've got to keep your population size pretty low or not run for very long and something like that. But this is actually the point at which you start getting overlapping sweeps.
What do you take M to be to come to that conclusion?
Okay, so I'm going to mention them. Actually, I should put down now. So the theoretical work, the first part of what I'm talking about, it was done in collaboration with Michael Desai, who is a string theory student at Harvard, and then decided to work on different kinds of dynamics with big numbers. So he had done some theory, and he then also did experiments in Andrew Murray's lab. So these are actually experiments on yeast in low glucose, and they were very controlled. I mean, it spent 2 years getting the controls down. And these were motivated by the theory of trying to test them. And one of the things you can pull out from that is the sort of characteristic mutation rate for the mutations which are dominating that population. It's not the total beneficial mutation rate. It's for the important ones. And I'll come back to later what that is. And there, our estimate for the number is sort of in the 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 5 range. You know, this is sort of a factor of 10 or so. So you get to this regime quickly.
Presumably that mutation rate depends on environment that you would.
Yes. So this was a boring environment. Yeast in low glucose, it wasn't very low. Its dividing was only dividing 30% more slowly than it normally does.
Compared to the environment in which the yeast has evolved.
Well, the lab yeast, right? Lab yeast has been for a long time in rich medium. It's probably mainly evolved to survive the freezer. So this is putting in a medium in which it grows 30% slower than in rich medium. It sees low glucose a lot of times in history. There's nothing in there that hasn't seen many times in the past. We intentionally put in low stresses because we didn't want to be dominated by a few big effect mutations. Okay. Things like where people look at more interesting things, like bacteria changing enough that they basically live off eating each other rather than eating the glucose. Those, if you put a typical in batch culture, so you know, by the time you end the day, you may have 10 to the 8th individuals. You've already produced lots of mutations which enable the bacteria to eat each other. I mean, people do not have good estimates of these rates. They do for big effect mutations, but for small effect mutations, this number we actually get it out is much bigger than, you know, our geneticist friends had told us it should be. But they're small effect. Okay. So it's not. So I mean, since I've mentioned the experiment, the typical S's that come out there that dominate are on the percent or two level. Okay, so they're small, but you've only got 30% sort of room anyway, in some sense, total. So, okay. So this then, I say, is the condition for sequential fixation. And you know, interestingly, this is not a theoretical exercise. You very quickly get out of that regime. Okay, and I'm sure Drosophila are always out of this regime as well. I mean, I'd bet some amount on it. Whether humans are. It's not clear, and of course recombination affects when you're in this regime. But if you look at the estimated rate of selective sweeps that people infer from data of genes, proteins in which there are evidence for selective sweeps between human-chimpanzee separation, okay, there's a selective sweep every few tens of generations. If you assume that a lot of them are regulatory, you multiply that up, and the average selective sweeps are probably once every couple of generations for human and chimp. Okay, so they're fast. Okay.
Maybe you'll come to this, but just throwing this out. Actually, none of this may actually be relevant to bacteria, in the sense that when you actually look at different strains, what really jumps out is that they differ, say, in 30% of their gene content.
Right. Right.
And
so, by some measure, if you just pick two random E. coli from your gut, their genomes differ by more than ours does from any other vertebrate. By some measures, right? So this is relevant for, you know, at this point, things are possibly relevant for, experiments in the lab, but if we don't understand these simple things, we ain't going to understand any of the quantitative things, right? And so the level of understanding, say, is so little that even knowing, you know, what parameters you would do in an experiment, right? Or if you're evolving in vitro single proteins and you want to ask how much should you do recombining, how strong selection you should put in, and you got to optimize that. Maybe some of the companies have proprietary papers on that in their own literature, but I haven't seen anything like that. It's how you actually optimize. Okay, and so there, again, you need to understand these kind of things. Obviously, all those things depend on the fitness landscape and so on, but this is, you know, one thing, purpose here, obviously, is to produce null models, and then, you know, if one's optimistic, one can hope to do some extrapolation. Okay. So that the next round of Brixlensky that can do everything with robots, can do many bigger populations, push them faster by various tricks and so on, what might they expect to see how fast might they expect to see things that have already been seen, you could ask. But no, I mean, all the objections are absolutely correct. And so, say at this point, I'm just going entirely to thinking about models. Okay. So once we get to n being much bigger than, say, this 1 over log s over m, then what happens? Okay. Well, in that case, you start having overlapping sweeps. So I can't draw this picture anymore so simply. Okay. What happens there is if I look at the ends, so I have my initial population here, that produces a mutation. This population starts growing. But before this population has grown very large, it gets to the size where NM is big enough that it starts producing beneficial mutations. Okay, its NMS is big enough. So this will start producing other ones. There'll be some little population will come in here. And if you get a bigger population still, this one will come in, get big enough to produce the next one before this one is swept. Okay, so then what happens? Well, then if I look at a later time there, then I've seen already. So this one is now better than this. So at some later time, this will take off. This one, of course, will take off first. So if I look a bit later, this is going to take off. This is going to start going down once that gets big enough because it's less fit. These are going to take off. These are going to start producing more and so on. Okay. So then I'm starting to get ones which are less fit than average. Okay. And of course, I go further, I'll get ones that are more or less fit than average. And so I end up with a situation that looks like this. So I've got them coming in here. Something qualitatively like that. These ones here are growing. These ones are shrinking. Phi bar is here at that time. And I have the one which is furthest forwards in the population, which is then going to produce the next one. Okay. So as far as mutations are concerned, the important mutations are the ones that occur up here. Okay. This guy is going to produce mutations to there, but they don't do much because this is already growing exponentially. They don't add much. Okay, and again here, the only important mutations are these ones that come in very near the nose, or the front, or whatever one wants to call it. Okay. So where is that front? Well, I'm just going to call it something here. I'm going to call this distance to the front being Q. Okay. Is it Q and phi look a bit too similar? Okay. So Q is the maximum phi at any given point, minus phi bar in the population. Of course, that's also dependent on time. Okay, so this is the lead. One can call this the lead. It's how far ahead of the average these ones are. Okay. So these ones then are the A students that are becoming the A plus students, and all these guys do is just hold down the curve. Right? They just lower phi bar, all these guys here. Right? Because I just said these two, that this would only have an advantage S. This is going to grow relative to this. So this is growing here at a rate which is E to the Q times T. And Q is many S if this gets far out.
Doesn't this require that the mutation rates are not too large? Otherwise, you could have somebody overtaking the lead.
So this is the M much less than S ensures this condition. You can do it when M gets big compared to S. Actually, Brusin and Wakely and Coffin did some things on that and get some similar conclusions, or you can infer them from their paper in the other limit. It's a messy in the other limit, but the basic behavior is not very different.
I'm still confused about how you're defining fitness. Because not the way I think about it normally, you say fitness is that the probability that a given parent is selected to be the parent is proportional to its fitness divided by the mean fitness of the population, right? So it's relative. And somehow you're not...
That's exactly that. It's just that the mean fitness...
So if that's the distribution of the fitnesses at one point, what's the probability that some parent, in one of those peaks there is chosen to be the parent of the next generation?
I think his fitness is just a log of your...
Okay, so it's 1 plus phi minus phi bar, okay, over 1, basically, because it's being this. But if this is always less compared to 1, this is just the logarithm of that, right?
Yeah, so it's multiplicative. So it's multiplicative. So what you're calling additive is really
multiplicative. I said it's multiplicative for the rates it's additive for the rates, it's multiplicative for the fitnesses. Okay? But that's only because historically people like to do every generation. Generations aren't continuous. Wright Fisher model should, you know, for, I'm still trying to find a co-author whose name is R-O-N-G, which is an existing paper, so can write, this is the wrong Fisher model. You know, that model's a religion, right? I mean, there's nothing special. But if you do continuous generations, everything else, these rates are the natural quantities anyway.
I mean,
and it doesn't matter.
The relation is m dot equal to phi minus phi bar times n.
Right.
So it's continuous.
Continuous time.
That's all.
Okay. But it only matters for normalization of time, right? I mean, the normalization of time here is 1 over s. You can think of the basic s as being very small. If it's 1%, as in the experiments, then as long as q is less than 50, the difference between the multiplicative and additive rates is negligible. But you can do all the analysis if you want.
You need another word for phi because it's not fitness as normally.
It's additive.
What is the right word for it?
Malthusian fitness.
Growth rate. I don't know. It's not log fitness.
Malthusian fitness.
Ah, okay.
Compared to Reichian fitness.
Okay, so it's the Malthusian fitness. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. I mean, I wouldn't have done explicitly, but you can do it if you really want to. You can do all the detailed mathematical analysis with a model with that in it. Say the difficulty then is if phi minus phi bar starts getting large, gets to being large compared to one, then things start depending on things in a much more complicated way. But you can do all of it and figure out what it would look like in that case. Just makes life more complicated. So it's much easier to do it with continuous equation, continuous time, and diffusion approximations with continuous n. And so then you can just say your starting point can just be writing down the stochastic differential equation for n and going from there. And it just makes a lot of things easier. A lot of factors you don't have as many regimes and so on. So it just makes life easier. But you can do all the analysis of putting in those effects. Okay. But the errors you make from the difference in this and those effects are much less than the errors that you would make in writing down the model in the first place. So it's one of these things that doesn't really matter. Same with a constant n constraint. N can fluctuate around a lot, and most of this doesn't change. Again, people don't like that. They like n being fixed. But that's, you know, again, that's sort of religion, right? That's... I should have specified it for the language.
When you show the speed vector, are you going to find the speed of the front, the nose front, to be the same as the speed defined by d phi bar by dt?
Okay, so that's obviously a crucial question. Okay, so if I look at the infinite n approximation, right, then there isn't the front because everything's there's always some individuals arbitrarily far out. Okay, so I can't talk about it in that case, but of course here I really can talk about it. So I've got the speed of the front. If this is going to be consistent, right? So I've got v, which is the speed of the mean, okay, and then I've got the speed of the front. So I've got the v of the front. Okay, the difference between these is the rate of change of q. If this is going to be a steady state, right? So for this to be a steady state, these had better be equal, or approximately equal in steady state, and on average they'd better be equal. Okay. So if V is going to be sensibly defined at all, the d phi bar dt, I had better get to something that's roughly a steady state. This could fluctuate around much more than this, okay, and it will fluctuate somewhat more. This could fluctuate somewhat more than this, but on average, the speed of the front, so the average of the speed of the front here, had better be the same as the as V.
You could imagine a situation where it's not a steady state, right? Where the width
and goes. In the case where you have a infinite n population, there isn't a steady state. Here, there is a steady state. Okay. So as soon as you go to finite n, there's a steady state. And this case we did, the small n, there is a steady state. Here, it fluctuates around a lot, right? Because the increases in phi bar a Poisson's jumps. Okay. Here, it goes much more smoothly. Okay. I mean, whether you see phi bar going by steps of s or by more smoothly depends upon the width of this distribution relative to s, relative to one step. And that, again, depends on the regime, and you get different behavior in different regime, but those are sort of uninteresting extra effects that if you really want to ask how, you know, other regimes, that comes in as well, but it's sort of a boring one. I'm going to pretend there's only two regimes, it's actually three or four, but the only two interesting ones, and it's just a matter of how they splice together.
Is it clear that it's always going to be a steady state, or there could be fitness landscape where it sort of disperses, or is it?
That's right. Certainly, I mean, a more interesting fitness landscape, it'll disperse. So this model particularly chose, because if this doesn't have a steady state, then you've got to understand why, right? And it does have a steady state. I mean, that's okay. In fact, the condition that this moves at the same speed as the mean, right, really is the condition for the steady state. Because this is really a situation where, if you think of this as being the tail of the distribution, the tail wagging the dog, right? The dog has got to follow its wagging tail. Now, you know, I like to think of it, especially owning a dog, this is the nose, and the nose fluctuates around rather a lot, and the sort of dog goes along at a smoother rate. So this is the nose, you know, leading the dog, but on, you know, average, not a very long time, the speed of the nose and the speed of the dog have to be the same. Okay. So,
do you think that this is a consequence of just that the fitness landscape is linear in this model, or do you think it holds more generally?
I could take a fitness landscape which looks like this. So, but as long as there's an average slope, then statistically I'll get some steady state, and how steady it looks will depend upon how much these variations are relative to the width of the distribution of the population. Okay, so it gets more complicated. Obviously, if you've got things with valleys and so on, then things get more complicated. I can say something about that later. But this is the absolutely simplest situation. Okay, so this is like asking, you know, what does one-dimensional Ising model have to do with the real one-dimensional magnet or five-dimensional magnet, right? And the answer is it's at least instructive to understand. And if you don't understand it, you're certainly not going to understand the higher ones. But no, absolutely, this is a special thing for this particular model. If my staircase ends at some point, then when I get to the top, I'll of course slow down and stop. If I have deleterious mutations as well, so a finite number of sites, as I come up, I'll start running out of beneficial mutations, and it'll slow down. You know, again, you can work out all those things if you have a particular model you're more interested in, but this is the crucial part.
Rather general, because right, you can imagine putting in some sort of entropic factor and ask how many states there are at a given.
Absolutely.
But it will just renormal.
And I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that in a while.
You can change right. Variables in the turbid probably.
Right. So you can have a lot of epistasis, and this basic picture will still work. Okay, at least if you put in a distribution of fitness steps. So I'll come to that in a little bit. Okay. But first to say, the main thing is to get across is to understand this. This model, and there's a very simple heuristic argument, at least very simple up the fact, which gives the right answer. Okay, and it really is just the condition that this is equal to this, and there's some sort of self-consistency. Okay, so what I need to do, I need to figure out what Q is, and I need to relate that to V, and then I need to relate the two of them to N. Okay, so I can sort of do it a little bit backwards. Is I can say, okay, let me fix the condition of V, make this equal to it, and then figure out what N that corresponds to. It's just a little easier to think about it that way around. Okay, so let's first look at the front. Okay, so I'm going to look at the nose here as to what's going on near there. Okay, so what we've got here is this population with phi bar plus Q. Okay, this is growing exponentially as e to the Q times t, and it's e to the q times t minus the time which I established this population at this q plus phi. Right? So this is the time at which I first had an individual there that was lucky enough to take off. Okay? I mean, for this purposes, this can just set zero of time. I'm looking at the beginning of that. Okay? And what I want to do is find when the next one starts. Right? So I want to figure out the establishment time of the next one up, the q plus s, like the going up one higher. Okay? So if I look at this here, okay, and then I want to understand the n of the phi bar plus q plus s. Okay. So what is this going to be? This is going to be n dot, is going to be n times this, right, which is therefore growing exponentially. And then it's it's this part here, it then is, say, growing at the rate. Q plus s. Okay, so it's growing at that rate there, so it grows faster times this n. And then it's got a fluctuating part, which is, you know, basically square root of n times noise, if you want to write it as a stochastic equation. Okay. So I want to look at this part here, and I want to ask, okay, what is the rate at which I'm feeding this? Well, then I can do exactly the same calculations I did for the single establishment originally. Right, where I was doing a single one and looking at the establishment of the next one. What I have to do is I have to produce enough mutations that one of them is likely to get lucky enough to take off.
Okay. So the population size is in the last term.
Sorry?
The population size, capital N, it's in the
Yeah, this is n. This is the number. This is the number of individuals in that population. Sorry?
N subscript is the number of the class, but I'm saying with the capital N, total population size. That's in the last term.
This here.
It's in the last term.
No. Total population size is n. This is the population size in this population here. Okay, that's the fluctuation thing. This is the fluctuation of that population. All right, so it's going to be fluctuating. This is the fluctuation just to do with birth and deaths in that population. This is the mean growth. This is the fluctuations in it. So this is n sub q plus phi bar plus s. Okay. So this has much bigger fluctuations. This one here, this is getting big rapidly. This doesn't have much fluctuations. It's growing exponentially. The definition of not having much fluctuations, it's already sort of got past this. Okay. So, and I mean, actually, it's actually, I mean, the way I sort of define things, it's easy to put a 1 over q there to when it establishes, but it doesn't really matter much. Okay. So what I want to do is I want to ask, when is this going to establish? Okay. So I want to look at the next establishment here, which is now I'm going to have some T establishment of Q plus phi bar, which is plus S, which is this one, plus some tor establishment of the next one. Okay, so this is going to be the next one. Okay. So what do I want to do? Well, let me set this to zero, so I'm just measuring things from there. And so then what I want to do is I want to look at the total number of mutations produced. Well, the total number of mutations produced of this type here, number of mutations into there, is just m times the integral from 0 up to tor of the of this one here. So it's just as e to the qt coming in there. Okay, and if I say, well, be careful, q there. Okay. So I need this. Well, how big does this have to be? Well, I have to produce enough of them that one of them establishes. The probability of the next one established is q plus s, so I need this to be of order 1 over q plus s, and that'll give me the first establishment. Okay. So if I just stick this on this side here, and if this was a constant, that's exactly the nms that I would get for how long that takes to happen. Okay, but this isn't the constant there, and so this is growing exponentially, but then you can immediately working this out. This is growing exponentially. It has to beat out this small factor of m. Okay, that's to get to be of order that. So you immediately conclude then that this tor established is of order, and this is approximately equal to it, stronger than being of order. It's of order 1 over q. That's the basic time scale for growth of these populations, times logarithm of q over m. Now s is much bigger than m already, so this log's a big factor. Okay, so this is just the point at which I will establish one of the next ones. Now, it turns out that you don't just establish one, you actually establish many. So if you do it a little more carefully, you end up concluding it's S back inside here rather than Q. Okay. So this is one condition. So that immediately tells us the velocity of the nose. Okay. This here, we can then go back, say, what does that mean for the V of the nose? So V of the nose is that I go step S by step S in this time here. So this is just QS over log S over M. Okay, that's one result. Okay. Now, of course, I don't know what Q is, so I have to figure out what Q is. Right? How do I figure out what Q is? Well, let's now look at this population here. We can look at this one here, and ask how long does it take for this to take over the population? Okay, from when it first establishes. So what happens there? Well, if I look at it more carefully, phi bar is moving at v. Right, so if I now am more careful here, what I really want is that n, I'm just going to drop the phi bar, so nq dot is growing as approximately as q times nq. Okay, but meanwhile, phi bar is coming up, so this is really growing as q minus v times t times nq. Right? Because the mean is coming up at speed v, and this is the v of the phi bar. So this is phi bar. So what is this then saying that nq then is going to be of order? How big is it going to be? It's going to be of order after a time t, e to the qt minus a half vt squared. Okay, and this is going to be maximum. So this is going to be maximum. So this is of order's maximum value at t is of order q over v. Okay, so you can think of that's then the time for sort of a sweep. It's a time for the initial one to take over the population, the new one to take over the population. So this is like a sweep time here. Okay, well, I mean more or less a fixation time from when it occurs. It's not quite the fixation times, and they call it a sweep. Okay, so this is of this order, and how big does it get? Well, by the time this is here, it's going to be the dominant one. Okay, so it's going to be now the dominant one in the population. So I've got my population with all these in here. Okay, so by the time this one gets up to here, it's going to be dominant. So this has got to be of order n, big N, up to something which is to do with the width of distribution and so on. So you can have to put those in if you're a little more careful. Okay, so this has got to be of order n. Okay. So what is that then? I just put the maximum in here, which is then, so this is of order e to the q squared over 2v. That's of order n. Okay. Well, I can work out what q is in terms of v over there, because now my condition for self-consistency is that the v nose has got to be equal to v. So if I set that equal to v there, that tells me the relation between q and v. So I just take that relation there. So that gave me q of v. Okay, this gives me n of q and v, so I can just solve those. And what one finds then is that v is approximately 2 times s squared, so that's just the basic units, times log n over log squared of s over n. If you want to, let me just get the right units, put that inside there. So here you notice something interesting right away. Okay, so obviously the crucial thing here is that this goes as log n rather than as n. Okay, so it went as n in the sequential regime, here it goes as log n. Okay, and I say it again, this is what Joachim already showed the other day. So. Okay. So the crucial thing, say this goes as log n in this regime here. If you sort of splice it onto the other one, you can do a little better, and let me actually just write that out. If I do a little better, I can put in a minus, take this, and put in minus a half log s over m. And then I can just take that and actually splice it on, and this is really there, I can take that and splice it onto the other condition before. So this is basically true as long as this is greater than or equal to s squared over log s over m. This is the condition, the point at which, when the speed reaches that, the sequential approximation breaks down. I start getting these multiple permutation regimes, and you see this gives you the right condition. So it's been there's a crossover, but basically it's very sharp, and that's all.
How serious are the approximate signs on that v approximate?
Asymptotically exact. Okay. Corrections. There's corrections of order 1 over powers of log. You can write down a function which is correct better than that, but it's not, yeah. So there, this is asymptotically exact for large n. Okay. For large n, this bit doesn't matter, but if this log is also large, then this is asymptotically, it's better, but the, yeah.
Can I ask the same question I asked Joachim the other day, which is how do you compare this with the neutral rate? I mean, if you want to consider S...
Neutral rate n, right? Is 1 over n.
So there's a u, but there's a u. There's the neutral rate depends on the rate of occurrence of the mutation.
Right, right.
And there's no, and u has disappeared altogether from your thing.
Okay, so I put a u in there, then I've got the u neutral coming in instead of m. U is going to be much larger.
M is the mutation rate. So
m is the beneficial mutation rate. So I could put in also, I could put in a u.
Take the limit of s goes to zero and turn this into a neutral model. That's
okay. If I take the limit of s goes to zero and turn it into a neutral model, then I can go back to the regime where I have small. Then I get to the condition where ns becomes less than one. Okay, and then everything's drift. Okay, now you can work out and just splice it onto this.
But does your limit, your equation doesn't have that limit as it is, does it?
So this is true. This particular equation is true for n, m, much bigger than what is 1 over log s over m. Okay. The other equation I wrote down, which was that v was of order nm s squared, and that coefficient is also 1, was in the limit where nm is much less than this log one of a log factor, and is much bigger than I messed it up last time. So if n gets down to be of order 1 over s, so this in this limit,
But we can't just...
Yeah, and this limit is sometimes always correct. I mean, it's not with the M much less than the...
I mean, there are two...
I can have to switch around the SM limit if you want to do that. So if I take S much less than M, okay, this is basically still... Let's talk about it afterwards. It gets complicated, but as soon as you're substantial N, drift takes forever. Okay, in microbial populations, drift basically does not occur. I mean, it's a strong statement, but I don't believe that drift is relevant in microbial populations, neutral drift.
But there could be another regime, right? There could be a regime NF small compared to 1 and F still large compared to M. So there could be still a selective regime, which is somehow weakly selective, which might be different from this one. That's not obvious. I mean,
if you're weakly selected, if S is small compared to 1, then the fixation rate is the neutral rate for fixation, and then you pick up a factor of S for each. Okay, so then you get up the neutral rate for fixation, which again has the M coming in there, and so then you will fix them at a rate which no longer depends upon N, but how long it takes to fix them comes in. So basically then it's MS or something like that. I'm going to have to, in that case. So there's the neutral case, which, if one's trying to splice them together, that happen. If you want to be precise, there's an issue whether this is big compared to the square of that, and so on. I mean, the main regimes when there's a selection going on are the this linear in N and MS squared and this one here. Okay, if you want to do for modest population size, so you've got drift, then you can splice things together, and or if you want to do viruses where M is much bigger than S, you can also do the same thing. Then, of course, this factor is not quite what comes in there, but it's still log NS, it's still 2S squared. And then there's just other factors that come in. Okay, so it's a different coefficient under S squared. I've forgotten what exactly comes in there, but it's... Okay. For microbes, I mean, almost all situations, this is the right regime with substantial population sizes. Okay, so this is really the relevant regime. This is not an artifact of theorists trying to find the interesting regime or the regime where it's hard to analyze. Now, if you work this out, you find that you work out more details. Of course, the tor is not exactly that. There's fluctuations around it and so on, so you can put in fluctuations. The fluctuations are very small in this regime. Basically, there's a small parameter, which is this log, associated with this log down here. There's other factors that come in as well, and the cube of that can come in and so on. So the fluctuations are small, and the fact that it goes along in a pretty steady state is a very good approximation. Okay, then this time here, in this sweep time here, roughly speaking, you've got a whole bunch of mutations coming in together. So here you sweep of order Q over S mutations together in this sweep time. Oh, I should just say what Q is. So Q, and you can see it doesn't go very rapidly, is roughly 2 log NS over log log S over M. Okay. In the experiments that Michael Desai did, we measured the distribution of the fitness. Okay, so we measured the fitness, how it grows with time, measured the distribution of it in the biggest populations with mutators, where you could most clearly, see the width of fitness and so on. It's, I say, embarrassingly consistent with the theory, especially as it shouldn't have been. And the numbers come out that so I guess there's a 2s here. So this I'm going to call little q. So it's just a number of classes above the mean. So this is the number. Actually, I should write it over here. So Q, which is Q over S, is the number of classes above the mean, which already exist. Okay, so it's just the integer.
How do you measure the distribution of fitnesses experimentally?
So you take out individuals. It being biology, you take out 96 of them. It's always 3/2 times the power of 2. Take out 96 of them. You grow up colonies from those, but not for long enough that you think there's much more mutations coming in. You mix them together with the original March strain. You run the ratios through a fax machine to count them. You then run it for some time. And you count again. Okay, and you look at the ratio. So you're doing it with respect to unmarked strain. Okay? If you do this and you do them all on the same day, I mean, the standard deviation we get of the fitness measurements is 0.5%, and just counting statistics would give you 0.25%.
So you somehow mark them after you take them out, and then you.
No, you've marked an original strain. You're competing against the original strain that hasn't evolved, mm-hmm. which is fluorescently marked. And so you count the number of fluorescently marked ones versus the other ones. And as long as the total fitness gain is not too big,
so
you...
So essentially in the same environment as...
Yeah. And the thing which you have to be really careful, and I think almost no other experiment I know of have done this, you really have to stay in exponential growth regime. If you're claiming that's what you're, you know, measuring, that's what things are for, as soon as you let the growth slow down, then the E. coli start interacting, or the yeast in this case, start interacting with each other, and we know for the yeast context explicitly that changes the behavior quite quickly. Okay, I mean from experiments. Okay. So you have to keep an exponential growth regime. It's a pain in the neck experiment. I mean, it's totally boring biologically. Okay. I mean, the only possibly interesting biological thing that came out of it was the fact that mutation rate to, you know, 1% things in boring environments is much higher than the biologists thought it would be, which is not an irrelevant number. Okay. Otherwise, it's totally boring biologic. It really is trying to do the idealized exponential growth, no one interacting with anyone else, and just competing for that, when there is not big fitness gains to be got, so it doesn't matter whether it's multiplicative or additive additive fitness and so on. So it's more idealized system than a chemostat, even though we go through serial dilution, because in a chemostat, everyone's always interacting with each other.
Okay. You said that more mutations pop out, not just a single one, there's a few. These few, how it depends on this time?
Yeah, so from the distribution and inferring what it looks like in the tails or from the theory, in our biggest populations, this is 4 to 5. Okay, so 4 to 5 mutations ahead of the mean are in there and are coming up together.
But how it depends on the parameter? I mean, do you have a formula for this 4 or 5 is coming from this?
It's this, yeah. But I mean, we can... Okay, so of course an experiment only measuring 96 of them, we would like to measure 10 to the 7th of them. So we have to make some, you know, inferences as to what's there. And this is the from fits to the M&S of rather a large amount of the data of distributions and other things, and sort of some arguments about the fact that you're in this regime and you can rule out the fact that you get a fixation of a small number, you get continuous. Anyway, it's complicated. And there's doubt. I mean, there's certainly potential holes in it. So, you know, it's all a consistent thing. But we can rule out a lot of other things, which are simpler versions. It's certainly in a multiple mutation regime. How far into it is, we really don't know. But it's certainly substantially into it. In fact, the smallest populations we have are already on the borderline. And the reason is because the experiment was designed based on numbers which we, you know, got from yeast friends, which were too low as far as what the mutation rate was. So even the small populations are, you know, borderline in this. So this is probably a good point to take a break, and then I can say I'm going to go away from doing any of the math in detail, but talk about diversity and recombination. Okay. So already in this... Here, there's no diversity, right? Except Boris already introduced it. We've assumed we've got one step up the hill, but if we've got infinite number of sites, of course, I can take the step at different sites, and as soon as I start mating, that matters even without epistasis. Okay, so the first thing one really has to understand, even to just know whether sex is good, is understanding that diversity. Okay, and the obvious assumption, and what seemed like it would be right, was that sex is in fact bad if you start mating. When one understands the diversity better, one realizes it already gets good if there's enough of it. And then I'll say something, and which I was getting more conjectural, but I'll write down some results that I think are correct. But at that point, I would give lower betting odds. So let's see, how long should we break? 10 minutes? Something like that?
10 minutes. Yeah.
Fischer diffusion process. So can you write down a, say, stochastic differential equation for it with multiple times for the a Reich-Fischer type covariance matrix?
It's exactly that, yeah.
Yeah. So it is exactly...
It's exactly the... Diffusion. It's diffusion with a...
You're dealing with a sort of traveling wave in this diffusion process. But
right.
It is actually a genuine Reich-Fischer type
It's not genuine Reich-Fischer in the sense that I'm fixing N by fixing phi bar, which ends up giving you a nasty nonlinearity. I mean, so it's.
But N's not changing over time, is it? N's
no, but the, you. I, but.
So that's enough.
But the way, I mean, it's not strictly speaking Reich-Fischer because I'm not taking one out and putting another one back in again. I mean, in the continuum approximation, I'm doing essentially that, but then you have to put in the nonlinearity in the right way.
I'm happy that the diffusion process has a multinomial kind of covariance structure to it. And is a genuine sort of stochastic differential equation.
Oh, no, this is certainly a stochastic differential equation, but I say the tricky part is that the stochastic differential equation includes phi bar, which it depends on everything else, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it could. It could.
Okay. So let me see that. So I can write it down. Okay.
Coefficients in the diffusion actually depend on the x's. Well.
No. Actually, only the selection depends on it. So the selection for the alpha denom generally is this minus phi bar of t.
Yeah,
okay. So I've got I've got an n alpha times this. Then I've got the mutation parts.
Yeah.
So this is n alpha dot. Okay. So it's this plus the mutation parts plus the square root of n alpha times some fluctuations, which Gaussian noise and white noise. But then the crucial thing is this. So then I just put in the constraint by saying this, in fact, has all the noises that come in as well. So these are independent, but I just define phi bar as exactly what gives me. So I do the sum on alpha, n alpha dot is equal to zero, and that gives me phi bar. Okay. So that's what I'm trying to solve, and then, it's a little cheat in how I handle phi bar, but. Okay. So what this does is it tells you the noise comes in here. It makes things nonlinear because the way this comes in, it depends nonlinearly on the ends. Okay, so if you actually try to say, can I analyze that exactly for two types, the answer is no. At least, well, maybe two, certainly not three. Okay, so you can only analyze it because you're an asymptotic limit of many types and many things coming in. Okay, so it really, and even doing it, so it really takes advantage of that, and then you've got a separation of times. Actually, so let me just say what the distribution looks like, and then I can explain just the... if I look at the logarithm of these n's of phi's, okay, instead of linear scale. Okay, so I've got the biggest one here, and then I've got a bunch of the other ones coming like this. Okay, and it turns out that the envelope of this distribution, okay, this distribution is very close to Gaussian, except in the tails. So it basically looks like Gaussian up to a cutoff, which is just Q, okay? Okay. But it has a variance, and the variance is much smaller than that. So it has a variance, which is up here, that's much smaller than that, which is sigma. Okay, and in fact, this fundamental theorem applies, that V is very close to sigma squared. So the variance, so there's just a variance in phi. Okay, it's very close to that, and that's because all this bit's dominated by selection. Okay, this bit down here is the only mutation. Okay. The problem with this theorem is it tells you nothing about what generates the variation. Okay, here all the variations generate at the front, which means it's very hard to try to get it from moment expansion and other things, which people have tried to do. Okay, so this is the variation phi. Now, why can one analyze a lot of things? Okay, the reason one can analyze a lot of things is there's a regime way up here, okay, where this is a drop of order one, up here where the nonlinearity is coming from fixed n are important. Okay, then there's a regime down here where the fluctuations are important. Okay. Then there's a whole regime in between where it's basically deterministic and linear. The nonlinearities don't matter. Okay. So that means that if you want, you can do this by branching processes. Okay. You do this, well, that's deterministic, that's trivial to do. Okay. And then you say, okay, well, let's look at the regime of validity. This branching process analysis is valid all the way up to here. So this branching process analysis, you could, if you wanted to, do all the way up to there. And you can, if you want to do multiple mutations at m large, you have to do that. This nonlinear, the nonlinear parts, the analysis, of course, works in the linear parts as well, as long as it's deterministic. So this analysis you do up here, you can do all the way down to, it comes from here, all the way up and down to somewhere down here. Okay. These have a big overlapping regime of validity, so in principle, everything is exact in the sense of matched asymptotic expansion and so on.
Right, with this equation here, for example, you've got a root n alpha there, so is
right.
That in a sort of branch process kind of regime rather than a Wright Fisher?
Okay, I guess we'll have to talk about. I don't know what Wright Fisher regime means,
that's
maybe.
Different.
Okay. But that's different by factors of two. I mean,
it's a
question whether fixations are S or 2S. It's a question I'm measuring things in discrete generations. All those is interesting to me. Those differences are much less than the errors in writing down any of these models in the first place, right? So all of those are universal things, things that don't depend on details of birth, death processes. All of those are captured correctly. So this I'm treating as n as being continuous. So this is what the diffusion approximation is exactly like this. Right. So it's diffusion. It's a diffusion approximation in multi dimensions, with the exception of this part. And it's still diffusion approximation with that. It's just there's a complicated extra piece which comes from that.
I think you might mean that noise should vanish if n alpha is equal to large n.
N alpha isn't equal to large n, right? No, someone the n alpha is large n.
But this is exactly the approximation.
Because
you're
in the
nose,
the
nose
is
at
the square of
that
alpha.
It's a branching process.
Can we do this afterwards? Because otherwise, yeah, we can't get to the other information. Okay. But this point I did want to make, which is why one can actually analyze things, and the fact that this is very close to Gaussian, many, many standard deviations from up here, which is unusual, but it's sort of trivial once one understands it. And the branching process things, or any other methods you want, can work down here, and then you can do up here. Now, if you want to understand things more, you just treat this front and this, and the stochastic front, which drives the dynamics of this at a later time, and self-consistently this catches up. If this gets too far ahead, this catches up, and so on. The front's exponentially unstable, but you can figure out all the times and how that all works. Okay? So you can put all the fluctuations. There's much more you can do if you really want to. Okay. So so that was the one comment I wanted to make on that. The other comment I wanted to just make was that if you look at a distribution of mutations. So if instead of taking M goes to S, I take a distribution mu of S, ds for mutations of size S. Okay, you can go through and do all the analysis again. If this goes as e to the minus S over some characteristic, I guess SB, I think you called it, to the sigma, then the to the beta. Then for beta bigger than one, there's a characteristic SB, there's a characteristic S that comes in, which I can call this, okay, and that is narrow. So if I look at the distribution here, say I did beta equals 2, so I've got some Gaussian distribution looks like that of the mu, okay, and there is a value here, and so I'm spreading this out, so here's sigma B. Then way out here, there is a narrow distribution which dominate, and this is S tilde, and that is narrow compared to S tilde. So in fact, the S tilde varies only by a small amount. It's only narrow by logs, but it still is narrow, and so it means, again, asymptotic things, as I pointed out, you approach very slowly, but you can do it, okay? So if in this case still here, then Q, this parameter of the number of things in the lead, so Q still, the lead class is still grows as log n, and the coefficient changes around. Okay, if beta is bigger than, if beta is between 1 2/3, then Q goes to some constant, which depends on beta for large population sizes. If Q beta is less than 2/3, then you basically only get two clones at a time. So this is like normal sequential. And in this case, the Gerasch-Lenski clonal interference is roughly right. Okay, it's not right in between. It's still wrong in between. This is still multiple mutations. At beta equals 1, it's probably log n. I mean, I haven't worked it out, but it's... So, and then the analysis gets more complicated. I mean, to pull out why this is true and to do the analysis there with the branching process of everything, then we're doing stochastic PDEs, but also just figuring out the sort of structure and why it's a narrow range here and so on, and figuring out the fluctuations in there is much harder. By the time you get down to these regimes, then things are no longer asymptotically exact, because things are asymptotically, in some sense, a large Q, but you can, you know, pull out which things are still right, and you start getting, you know, order one errors rather than errors down by one of the logs. But it's, so that's what happens if you have a distribution. Okay. So now the question is, why on earth should this work for the experiments? Okay. Well, one of the crucial things is that the way this depends on population parameters is very weakly, as long as the distribution falls up pretty fast. This really depends very weakly on the population and parameters. This doesn't depend upon n, in this case here. So in this case, at least the beta bigger than 1, the beta bigger than 1, that S tilde is independent of n. It depends on the mutation rate, but doesn't depend upon n. And if you look at only weakly on the mutation rate, and if you, so it's not unreasonable that if you had an additive or multiplicative fitness, that you would be well approximated by constant S. But of course you've got epistasis. But what does the epistasis do? Well, in a simple approximation, the crucial feature is that I have many different directions I can take uphill steps. They have different sizes. they can interact with other genes and so on. Okay? So the crucial fact is that if I take a step up in some direction, that the distribution of the sizes of the next steps I can take stays roughly the same. Of course, exactly which steps there are will depend upon what direction I took. Okay, so I can have, you know, a lot of epistasis here is something which is in there. What's not in here is sign epistasis, but that you can put in, and it turns out in these regimes the effects of, even though n is very large, and so normally you would expect to be able to get through valleys and to higher peaks. That process takes a while, and as long as there are a substantial number of single mutations available, it doesn't play much of a role. If things start to slow down, then it can play a big role, or you can just, you know, occasionally get something anomalously large coming from a multi-hit mutation. So you can make a sort of pretty good justification why, as long as you're in an environment where the evolution is dominated by a lot of small effect mutations, right, which is what a lot of discussion has been about, going back to my namesake, this is a reasonable approximation for large population sizes. Okay, and they say there'll typically be a dominant S, and there'll be it'll be uphill steps, even though you're going many directions at once. Okay, and the crucial thing is this fact that you're going many directions at once. Okay, in the staircase picture, you're going up one step, but as I said, that one step corresponds to lots of possible mutations. So the first thing we have to figure out is what is the diversity in the population. Okay. And without that, we can't talk about sex. Okay. Well, we can try. So we can look at the simple picture, and we can say we've got one mutation coming in. Okay. So if I've got one new mutation coming in, all that really matters is what happens at the front. So this is one mutation coming at the nose, that takes off, and that dominates the population. So this is the normal picture with a sequential thing, right? It's the first mutation there. If they're all the same size, that wins. If you've got clonal interference, it's more complicated. But basically, one of them wins. Okay. If that's the case, then sex makes life worse. Okay. Why is that? Well, if you look at this here, okay, there's one mutation here this has got. Above the mean, this one has one mutation. This one's got that mutation plus another one. This one's got that mutation plus another one. Okay? So the effects of those are additive, but there's only one of them. So this has the most, and it's guaranteed that if you mate this one with anyone else, it's going to decrease its fitness. So if you do this, then before you mate, you have a distribution that looks like this. Before you mate, and after you mate, you have a narrow distribution. Okay? So sex is bad. You're breaking up good combinations. They're not good in the sense of epistasis until you start thinking, wait a minute, this is saying there is kind of epistasis actually, but that basically sex is bad. Okay, so this means that whether sex is good or not, you know, sex, you could have some diversity and sex would still be bad. There has to be enough diversity for the sex to start winning. So this is really a quantitative issue, even in this trivial model. Okay? And the crucial part is that we've got to understand the diversity. Okay? And it turns out that almost all the diversity is generated at the front. The nose. Okay. Now at this point I'm just talking about beneficial diversity. You can talk about other things we can add in. Okay. So I want to look at the diversity, and the diversity is that it comes from the nose. Okay. So if I look at the population which is giving rise to the mutants, so if I look at the Qth population and I look at this NQ, the function of time, okay, it's starting at some range here, it's fluctuating, and then it's growing exponentially. It's e to the qt. And this is giving rise to the mutation, so the next one. Well, if the mutation rate's very small, I have to wait quite a long time here, so this was this time of order L over Q, log S over M over Q. I have to wait until I get the first one. So somewhere in here I'm going to get the first one. Okay. If I don't happen to get that one there, this is going up very rapidly, I'm going to get it soon afterwards. Okay, so in fact it's this plus order minus order 1. Okay, when I get the first one. Okay, so they're pretty deterministic when you get the first one. Okay, but then of course, I don't just get that one. At some point here, this is raised up further, and I'll get a second one. And then I'll get a third one, and I keep getting more and more closer and closer together as this goes up. Okay, so I'll get many coming in. However, these guys are behind, right? They're establishing at a later time, so they're going to be behind the first one. They're all growing at the same rate, so this one wins. Okay, this one gets there first, but they're not that far behind. Okay? And so you can ask, how many of them matter? Okay, sort of in a typical sense. Okay, and the thing is, they basically matter for anything that comes in at a time, over a time window of order 1 over S. Actually, small compared to that. But basically, anything that comes in at a time window of order 1 over S matters, because this feeding population, they're coming in exponentially fast with Q, they're losing out by not growing as either the Q plus S for some time. And so basically, it's when this is the time scale over which the mutants, the new mutants, beat the ones that they're being feeding their population. Okay. So anything that comes in over this time scale is order 1 over S. Okay. So if you then look at that and ask how many of those, it turns out the number that come in a loose sense is in fact, this number here is of order Q. It's of order the number of how far the lead is, so the number of classes in the lead. Okay. So this is the number of different mutations in the lead population. Okay. Then, of course, as it grows, you get a little bit more diversity, but those mutations really don't have much chance to catch up. Once it's gone already fast, these are quite far ahead, they can make other mutations. So it really is these ones that dominate. Okay. But now, of course, there's a distribution. Okay. So if I ask, what is the distribution of the sizes of these, right? I'm going to have different classes. So if I look at, if I divide up my lead population, I'm going to have the one that gets there first is going to be bigger typically. So the one that gets there first is the biggest. The one that gets there next is a little smaller. The next one a little smaller, and so on. And what I mean by of order Q is roughly speaking that, you know, if I say I want to capture 70% of them, this is of order Q. There's of course many, many more smaller ones down here. Okay. And actually the total number that come in eventually is something like of order, this total number is something like n to the 1 minus 2 over q, I think, that come in eventually.
So let me try to understand how this picture is related to the pictures that you drew before. I mean, this is everything.
This is diversity within one class.
All of these guys have this exactly the same fitness. So
right.
They all sit at the 4
So these are all the same fitness. Well, right now they sit there. But if I wait for a sweep time, they all dominate the population. Right, so after a time of order sweep time, these are the same fitness. These dominate. Right. So this is now the big population.
This is all during the time when the most fit class is still, the same.
That's when they're produced.
Right.
That's when they're produced. But then they take over the population in this time. So then they become the majority. These are the dominant class. Totally, these add up to about n. Big n. So after this time here, the total number in here is of order n of those in the population.
Right.
The number of classes is this order. It's almost, it's not much smaller. The number of different ones. Okay, but mostly it's these ones that matter. Okay, these ones are the only ones that have substantial chance of taking over the population. Okay, these ones, okay, they rise to some fraction. They're not going to stay. Okay. So the biggest one here is typically this biggest one is of order 1 over Q fraction. The fraction of order 1 over Q. Okay, so this is a fraction of order 1 over Q. Okay. But with probability of order 1 over Q, okay, the largest one, has F of order 1. I mean, over half, say. Okay, so there's some chance the biggest one is half. Okay. Now, what these actually are, these are from a Levy distribution. So there's a Levy distribution with parameter. Oh, I always forget the way it's defined. It's a one-sided Levy distribution whose Laplace transform is e to the minus lambda to the 1 minus 1 over q. If you look at the distribution of these sizes. Okay, so it's a Levy distribution. It's got a long tail, which is associated with this. But most of the time, it's well-behaved because q is large.
Okay. Is this a generating function? Or?
This is the Laplace transform of the distribution of the frequencies. Okay. So then you've got a whole bunch of things drawn independently from this distribution. And the Levy distribution is the property that if you draw a whole bunch of them independently, you can draw a very large number, and a substantial fraction of it is going to be in the largest one. Okay. So what I just said in answer to the previous question was what fraction is typically in the largest one, the distribution of that. But of course, I really need to know the distribution of all these frequencies and so on in order to understand things. Okay. So this is the distribution they come from. I said that's easy to work out. Okay. So I've got substantial diversity, not enormous, but I have substantial diversity in the population. Okay, and say particular diversity is more or less of order Q. Okay. So now I can look at the coalescent process. Okay. So what happens is these are produced here. After some time, they're now the biggest guys. Pictures. So I'm producing my small population here. And the mean was up there. I wait some time. This has now become the dominant population. Okay? And the diversity just carries forth. You add a little bit to it, but it basically carries forth. Okay? So diversity carries forth to here, and that now dominates the population, the ones in the middle. So they have all this diversity produced in the front. Plus, of course, the one after them, which is already, you know, already getting pretty big, has some of my diversity endings as well. Okay? That doesn't add that much to it because it sort of builds up slowly. So you can sort of crudely say it's just this diversity here, now amplified all the way up to being of order n. Okay? So I can look at that, and I can then ask about the coalescent process. And I really, this is asking about the coalescence of these things with the beneficial mutations. Okay? So I can think of this, crudely, as being a coalescent process in a population whose size is of order q. Okay, so there's some sense in which, certainly for the coalescent and some other things, okay, I have an effective population which is of order q. Okay. The time associated with this, the basic time is being to move one step. So that's like the effective generation time is to move one step. That's the effective generation time. If I look at what happens then, well, in Q of these effective steps, then I'll typically coalesce. So this means I'll typically coalesce in some time, which is of order, so the coalescent time, which will be of order then, it'll be of order this, the effective population size, times the step size. Okay, the step size is whatever it is, S over V. Okay? So what is this? This is just Q over V, which is one, which is the sweep time. It's just the time to go from here to here. Now, of course, it's really, you have to go several times that to coalesce. So the characteristic time for the coalescence is sort of the naive result that you might have guessed, you know, from this picture, even though you wouldn't figure out the diversity or how big it was or anything. But, you know, it's roughly speaking the time for this, for these ones to take over. Okay, and then some of them really, of course, that really corresponds to them really fixing in the population. They fix in bunches, okay, but they will fix in the population.
So each one of your delta functions there is identical in sequence, right? It's not
no.
It's just the same
no.
sequence with difference.
No. It's okay. Not identical in sequence, it's identical in fitness.
Okay.
But it's divided up just that way. So here's so there's a big one up here, so that's one of them, then there's another genotype in here, and another one here, and so on.
They're in the same peak doesn't mean that they've coalesced in the
no.
sequence.
No. No, they don't. They won't coalesce until later than this. Well, I mean, some will coalesce already. Have started coalescing in sequence space. So they coalesce in sequence space, but a time of order this time back. So by the not, you know, they sweep. They get into the population, and then the coalescence of saying backwards in time is a few times this. Okay. However, and this is different than normal coalescence. This is like corresponding to an extremely broad distribution of birth rates, right? Of individual in the population, very very broad distribution of number of offspring, right? Because one of them has half the total offspring, and then there are these little tiny ones that have almost no offspring, right? But there are a lot of them. Okay, so this is corresponding to a very broad coalescence. I think John Wakeley, I think, has worked something out on this, and this recently. I don't know if he take his results directly over. Okay, so in a normal coalescent process. The time for the last coalescent, right? The time for the last coalescent is of order the typical time. Right, so if I'm going backwards in time, I start with some number down here, and these start coalescing and so on. Here I get three coming together at once, so that can happen, which doesn't usually happen so much. So I go back and I can look at a typical coalescence and between, you know, two randomly chosen ones, so it'll be back here. If I look at the last coalescence where everything coalesces, it'll be the same order. Right? So everything will come together if I go further on. Okay. And the characteristic time for everything that come together is the same as the characteristic time, I mean, a factor of two or so, as the characteristic time for any pair to come together, typical pair. Okay. That's not true here. And the reason it's not true is because of these very large number of small classes. Okay. So here, the sort of T of the total coalescence, I don't know what it's called, the last or something like that, when you lose all of these, okay, this total coalescence, what that is a longer time, not by much. This is of order the same time here, so it's the typical coalescent time, times a factor which is log n. Okay.
So the T call is T2, that's for two individuals?
So this is a typical one, this is a typical. Okay, but it's not only just typical, it's almost always. Almost any pair you pick will go like that. Okay, there'll be some distribution to it. The distribution of those has an exponential tail, so it's a conventional tail.
So what's the shape of this? If you pick a random two,
yeah.
What's the probability that the shape of the distribution the coalescence time for a two random individual?
It's different than it would be for a conventional one.
So what does it look like?
I don't know, I haven't worked it out. But it may be probably in Wakeley's paper. Okay. So it turns out that we were interested in the diversity because we wanted to start talking about sex. Okay. So the conventional way to think about sex I'm going to explain why it doesn't matter. The conventional way to think about sex is, I think, of mating two, you know, random individuals and looking, you know, whether on average those are fitter or not fitter, does it increase the variance, and things like that. Okay. In these big populations, that ain't what matters. Okay. All that really matters is, are there some pairs of individuals who, when they mate in the population, will end up being way fitter than average? Okay. If I ended up after mating with a distribution that looked like this, okay. So if I have initial, say, distribution before mating, so that's my back of the distribution, and this is my front of it, so that was the Q before mating, coming from the asexual. And if I ended up with a distribution after mating that looked like this, so it was much narrower and higher, so if it looked like that, okay, but had a longer tail after sex, okay, all this stuff doesn't matter. The fact that distribution is narrow, because this one's going to take over the population, and this descendant are going to be the ones that matter. Okay. So the question is, what is the typical largest one I'll get in the population? Okay. So this is in terms of a coalescent process. I have to be very careful, because if I look, the obvious thing to do is look at the distribution of pairwise coalescences and ask, when does that get to be of order 1 over n? Right, I've got n matings, and so the largest coalescent time I'll find, and then I have to go back and ask what happens when I mate those. Well, then they're diverse enough, and you can pick up roughly twice as many, okay, beneficial mutations, all the ones that have, you know, extra ones since the coalescence time. And so you have to think about, if you do that, okay, that's the obvious thing to do. Then you would conclude that this goes up by log n, without the log, if you did the natural calculation. But the problem with that calculation is one confused what you're doing in a single population with the ensemble of populations. If I take a very large number of populations, exponentially large, doubly exponentially large probably, okay, take a very large number of populations, and I ask what is the distribution of the ones I'll get by mating n of them with one population, that'll have a long tail out to of order log n. Okay. But what I really need to ask is, in a typical population, what is the best that I can do for mating? The best that I'm likely to do, it's not the best I can do, the best I'm likely to do with by doing n matings. Because I'm taking the asexual evolved population and I'm just mating it randomly within it. Okay. And then the answer is that this one here, okay, this Q after sex is of order Q before sex times log n. Okay. And all kinds of details in, like, what kind of sex you're having, how much of it and so on, what kind of recombination, all of those end up giving you plus order one corrections. Okay, the log is not very big, but they give you order one corrections. Okay, so do the random fluctuations in this. So it's like an extremal statistics thing, is the biggest one you're likely to find doesn't depend much, the fluctuations in that are small. Okay. So with high probability, you'll find log n. Very occasionally, you'll find of order log n. Okay. But that doesn't matter. With probability approaching 1, you'll find of order log n. Okay. Now, log n is not a very big factor, but you can figure out even for moderate Q, you gain. Okay. I'm not sure whether for Q of 3 or something like that, whether the sex actually gains, and I haven't tried to work it out. But, I mean, it's an easy calculation. Well, a well-defined calculation. Straightforward calculation. Okay. So this says that the sex will gain. Now, in fact, this actually isn't correct. In fact, with sex, you will also broaden the variance, and you get a longer tail. Okay. It doesn't look Gaussian anymore. Well, it is for a while. It's not Gaussian out in the tail. It stops being Gaussian sooner. But I say the crucial bit is this, because it's now way ahead of the mean. Right? If it's way ahead of the mean, this goes exponentially very fast, faster than the mean can catch up. So if I look at what happens afterwards, this grows, it produces new mutants, this one, it can't keep up, and basically, this thing and its descendants take over the population, and you actually decrease the diversity. The first thing that happens after sex, you decrease the diversity, and then you have to build it up again. Okay, this goes on, you build it up again, and if you wait long enough to build it up, you can do the same thing again, and have sex again. Okay. Just one sec. The characteristic time scale between the sex, this is periodic sex, say, which is roughly what yeast do, irregular at least, periodic mating, then if the time for this, so if I think of a time for this, the time between this, so it's of order some effective recombination rate, if this is bigger than 1 over, or than log S over M over S, which is the sweep time basically, okay, then you start picking up substantial effects of sex. Okay, if it's much less than that, you don't gain much. If it's much more than that, life gets very interesting. Okay.
So I was just wondering whether these fit guys out in the tail after sex, whether they're produced by matings within the of two individuals in the bulk or of two in the tail, or like...
Okay, no, very good question. So they're actually typically produced by two individuals way in the bulk. In the bulk. So that's
a kind of binomial distribution of these mutation numbers.
Yeah. Once you've chosen two individuals that coalesced a long time back, then you've got binomial distribution of the numbers between them. And then it depends on the recombination type, right? Are you going to recombine freely? Are you going to divide the chromosome in half and recombine? Okay. So you get all those factors there. Okay. And then there are factors which are coming from... right. But they typically will be from the bulk of the population. Okay. But what they will be... They will typically be someone from the common population, a pretty common population, mating with someone from an extremely rare one. So you wouldn't even find the two relevant populations unless you sample everything. So there's these n to the 1 minus 1 over q populations in there, 1, 2q, whatever. It'll be one of those very rare things. There are a small number of individuals. I mean, small on a log scale. There'll be still large numbers.
Statement about the Hamming distance between...
Well, the Hamming distance between them is the coalescent time is the sort of the maximum, twice that is the maximum Hamming distance, and then you just look at the distribution of that, assuming it's random, and you'll get it right. Okay. But that depends on the recombination.
But the distribution within one class is not, or the distribution between classes is not much bigger than the distribution within one class.
That's right. And there's a large, many more of them within one class than there are if you take one from here.
Right.
Okay. So it's a very rare thing you take, but it's not the very rare thing that was already fit. Okay, it's a very rare thing that happens to be most different. And so it's already, I mean, that's, you know, qualitatively interesting thing. What dominates is the most different individuals mating with someone else, and actually in this case it actually dominates by mating with a pretty common one, rather than already the most fit individuals. They're likely to do worse. Okay, so for these guys out here, they don't want to mate. I mean, they're doing very well on their own, right? it's all these guys in here, that, you know, the majority that want to mate, but they'll produce a few way out. Okay. And again, in microbial populations, you know, this is, I mean, firstly, this, you know, a periodic sex being a reasonable approximation is not, is probably not bad. You know, big numbers doesn't happen all that often, and so there's, you know, the 1 over R is a modest sized, is a relatively slow rate, and then we have to start, then it's a quantitative matter, right? It's a quantitative matter. You also have to ask, are we producing enough diversity for it to matter? For the sex to help, and I say, you know, the simple assumption is that it doesn't, it makes it worse. So one really has to understand it in quite a lot. If it wasn't for this log n, if it wasn't for this tail, it really wouldn't help, or only barely. Okay. I mean, it really is trying to understand the rare individuals. So this is saying that for both the asexual evolution, which is the ones up in the nose, they dominate, right? And the, so I guess that was the A students becoming A plus students. With the mating, it's really the C students. Well, at Harvard, the B plus students, or Stanford, the average ones, who get really lucky on the exam. I mean, those, or who they copy from. No, I know he's really lucky on the exam. Right? And so, you know, it's a different process. But in both cases, it's extremely rare things that matter for the evolution. Right? I mean, that's, you've got to maintain the diversity by producing new things. And so, whether you have to produce it by recombinations or by asexually, it's the sort of, you know, the best ones that really matter. And all the analysis, I mean, there's tons of stuff in literature, you know, means and variances and so on. Okay, but that's very misleading, and that's not what dominates the dynamics on time scales longer than, you know, basic selection when you get rid of your, you know, move by one standard deviation in your fitness. And if you move by one standard deviation of fitness, beyond that, you can't do all the normal things. So what I just want to do in the remaining little bit, I just want to say now what happens if one has sex seriously. Okay. So this is periodic where I've evolved asexually, and the reason we can sort of understand this so well is because we understand a lot about the asexual evolution. Okay, once you start putting in real sex, then things change a lot, and what the literature says is even more confusing and probably even more wrong, mostly. Okay, so now I want to have recombination often. I want to have a lot of recombination. So this is going to be large. Okay, now the question is large compared to what? Okay, and that's of course all these things is crucial. Now, I could consider various models of this. I could consider, for example, a model where I have just completely free recombination, so I divide my chromosome up in a large number of bits, and I just take these out and completely throw them in a pool and pull them back together again. Right? So any given locus after mating, will have any fraction of any of the other alleles independently chosen. Right? So it's completely free recombination. It's the best you can do. I mean, it's the most sex you can have. Okay. And if I only have one beneficial mutation per allele, or if I make these even shorter sections, then you mix everything up after one generation. Okay. And then after one mating, and then the standard statement is that this whole clonal interference stuff you get rid of. Okay. So the standard statement is if you have a lot of recombination, then you go back to the speed of the evolution being dominated by the creation of the mutations, each of them act independently, and you've got this. You go back to this again. Each of these SIs becomes independently evolves. Okay. This statement is true if you fix N, okay, and take R to infinity. Okay. But it's not true if you fix R and take N large. Okay, it's much more the realistic situation. Okay, so fixing N, take R to R infinity, this is true, they evolve independently. Every generation completely mixes things up, they're independent. Okay. However, you have linkage. Even in this model, you have linkage, if R is a bit smaller. Okay, why is that? Well, the guys you're linked with for a short time have a lot of variation in their fitness. Okay, so as soon as the variations in the fitness gets to be substantial, this breaks down. Now, it actually turns out it breaks down or starts breaking down before that. If you look at the maximum variation in the fitness, so we have this Q, which is the maximum variation of fitness. So in between recombinations, right, these guys are going to grow by e to the q times the time, so roughly e to the q over r, between recombinations. If this gets to be much bigger than 1, okay, then the linkage effects are important for your evolution. If you're on the other side of the distribution, or even if you're in the mean, okay, you're screwed. Oh, oops, wrong word to use in this context. When this gets big, but so the obvious first crossover occurs when R is comparable to Q. Okay, Q is getting bigger and bigger, population size. So this is something which already you need to have the R's at least naively bigger. But now, sure, that's not the right condition, but there's something like that. Okay, so once this is true, okay, then the linkage crucially affects your evolution. Linkage becomes important. You're not linked forever, but things change. And then, you know, you care a lot about the ones you're linked with. Now, the problem is, you don't want to be linked with guys, even good guys, you don't want to be linked with for too long. Because if you're linked with really good guys for too long, you're still staying still, and on average, the rest of them are passing you. Right? So you can start off being the fastest guy, right? But if you don't have recombination, the other guys are going to catch up. And the other guys are taking advantage of many more mutations than you are because you've just got the new mutations coming in yourself before you recombine. So this linkage, no matter how lucky you are initially, okay, and join a new mutation joins a very fit one already, you have to get away from that in not too long, otherwise the other guys catch you up. Right? Because it's the best of the other guys that catch you up. The individual one won't, but the best of them will catch you up. The ones that happen to do recombination more often or happen to be luckier in their mating choices and so on. Okay. So then it gets very tricky again. Okay. So I'm just going to write down some results. And let's see, I think one of these I actually believe. The other one I think is probably correct. But I'm done. Anyway, okay. Let's see. So now this starts depending on the type of recombination. Okay. So if I do this recombination here. Actually, that's not the one. Which one do I have written down? Okay. Yeah, okay, okay. So if I do this recombination here, then it turns out there's various characteristic R's that come in. It turns out once R already starts being much, much bigger than the mutation rate, some things start happening. Okay. Then there's things that happen when R is comparable to S of a log S over M. Then there's things that start happening when R is of order the square root of the VA sexual. Then there's things that start happening when R is of order the this Q and so on. I mean, there's already a lot of regimes, okay? But the interesting ones when R gets to be potential, again, the sort of one that's most interesting. And there, if we just sit at fixed N, so at fixed R, and take N large, okay? So then what happens eventually, the recombination is the one that matters, and then the V becomes 2 log MN. Now here you notice MN appears again. In the asexual case, MN didn't appear. Right? NS appeared and S over M appeared. Here we go back to the mutation rate appearing. Okay, so it's log MN, I don't know, whatever it is, S minus R squared over log squared, S over R, something like that. So this, the crucial bit is this bit here goes as R squared for R much bigger than S. Okay, R squared over log squared of R. Okay. So I go back to something very similar to before. It's just that my basic rate now, instead of being S squared, has gone to being R squared. So I gain by basically a factor of R over S squared, but I'm still log N rather than N. Okay. And this is with free recombination. I throw everything together. It's pretty extreme. Okay.
It's a free recombination. What does R mean? Is an R a half? Why is R a parameter if it's free recombination?
Oh, because I'm not mating every generation still. Okay, so an average individual has a probability R per generation of mating. Okay, yeah.
So, but V is still the speed of the mean fitness. So how come it doesn't depend on the fitness scale if R is much larger than S?
Good question. If I'm in the other case, it hardly depended on mutation rate, only logarithmically. Okay, here there's corrections which depend on the...
But in this case, at least we had an S squared in the beginning.
Okay, so the thing that... What the basic effect is the following. So I get a new mutation arising, obviously, at rates MN. Okay, so what is this, right? This is S times the fixed... times the rate of new mutations. So it's S times NM, right? That's the rate of producing the mutations. Sorry, this is the effect on V. This is the rate of producing the mutations, okay? And then I've got the probability of fixing. Probability of fixing a mutation, okay? So the only way I can get something like this if I have a very low probability of fixing a mutation. And in fact, the probability of fixing a mutation is exponentially small, okay? And there's various ways to see that. One is because, say, there's linkage. You have to be linked with the right guys. You have to give them up at the right time. You have to mate again and be linked with good guys again. You have to keep doing that, okay? But there's another way of thinking about it, which is there's all kinds of fluctuations up and down in the population. So if you follow one lineage, okay, and so you follow that one lineage, some of the time you're combined with good guys, and then you grow a lot. Then you recombine with bad guys, you shrink a lot. So the fluctuations get driven up enormously. Okay, they get driven up so much that the you end up with an almost no mutations fix. Okay, some of the mutations fixed, but exponentially small number of them. But exponentially smaller numbers that end up, I think, working out that in terms of that. And this is basically true as long as R starts being big enough that you start mating before things have swept. Okay, so the basic, the sort of this sort of crossover is the more relevant one. And then eventually, you know, the R much bigger than S, and say you just go to this R squared and S drops out. Yeah. Okay. So this is to say, this is the extreme case of free recombination. You can also do a case with.
This basically means that the allele frequencies are being bounced around by sort of your linkage disequilibrium much more than by anything else.
Yep, way more. Right, so it's the same as drift, right? Drift basically in these big populations doesn't exist. Draft, I think Gillespie calls it, right? Which is where you're being linked to beneficial things. Okay, it's fluctuating out all over the place, so you're getting effective drift here, right? So this is going to look like if you put neutral mutations into this mix, which we could have done in the asexual case, they will be fluctuating around. They'll fix at the usual rate, the neutral mutations, but the distributions will be very different, and the effective population size will be tiny. Okay, It'll be tiny as far as the chances of finding them halfway up. It'll be tiny, but they'll fix much faster. So then you don't have to wait time of order n for mutations to fix, for neutral mutations to fix. They'll fix a lot by hitchhiking. Okay. So here, you're hitchhiking, but you know, you keep getting off cars that are going in random directions. On and off cars in random directions. And that's giving you the whole effect. Okay. And unfortunately, if cars are driving fast, then you know, it's a little dangerous doing free recombination.
So the car should contain s in some way, doesn't it?
Sorry?
So r is kind of how often you switch cars.
It does contain. It does depend on s, but that's just a correction.
Yeah, that's
sort of
what I
yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's some, these are sort of surprising. Okay. So
I'm happy with one form of R in there.
Okay. Okay, well, if you're happier, I'll give you one example with S coming in as well. Okay. So another one I can do is I can do transformation. I think it's called that. This is more relevant for microbes. So I've got my chromosome here. I'm going to take one section out, small section, and take this and put it in, you know, replace it so it goes over here. Okay, so I'm moving one allele at a time. Okay. Okay. And I'm going to do that at rate R per generation. Okay. So what do I mean by that? I mean that any little segment has a chance R per generation of doing this. I don't mean that the chance of moving some segment R is R. I mean that any little segment has rate R. So of course there's two processes. This one can move out with rate R. Okay? And then there are many others that can come in, many other possible ones that come in. But this is sort of a mixture of two processes, one of which is the allele we're looking at jumping to another chromosome. The other one is things coming in, jumping to another organism. The other one is things coming in and affecting us here. So it's sort of, it's not as extreme as the free recombination, but it's still a lot of recombination. I mean, R here, in some sense, it still symbolizes something which is much faster than any, what you would normally call the rate for this process. Okay, this is really the rate for a particular one. Okay.
So the thing that comes in is a copy of some random allele at that point from the population.
Yeah. So this will be a random allele of this type. Sorry, it comes in over here. Drawn from the whole population randomly, yeah.
So you don't really... So what you need to know is what's coming in, and you don't... It's, I mean, you don't swap things over. You just make another copy of something that was there and replace...
Right. Right, so you need to know the distribution of what comes in here. So all these things, you need to know the distributions of these in the population. Right, so this is allele alpha. I need to know the frequencies of alpha in the population. Yes. And I need to know the distribution of those over all the alleles and so on.
The recipient of the new gene, but there's no real donor, right? Because the thing that's going in is a copy of something, and it doesn't affect the donor.
As long as R is small compared to a generation time, that's a reasonable approximation, but you can think of the owner dying and giving it to someone else, and that's roughly equivalent. So it's not. But it's not. It isn't. If you mate every generation, then of course that effect much bigger. Here that effect's small.
But there's like two processes here. One is your genetic background of that particular bug decorrelates,
right,
because you couple it to the genetic,
right,
to the pool. And the other one is the option as a...
There's two processes, exactly. But I mean, biologically, they're equivalent processes, right? It's just, if only from the looking at it from the point of view of one allele, do they look like different processes, right? They're the same biological processes. It's just when you're looking at one allele, and the way to understand these things in a general sense is, at least the ones that I understand so far, is you say, okay, I've got this one allele, but I've got many other alleles in the population, all of which are trying to fix. I've got frequencies of them, most of them small, some of them large. If there's enough of the frequency substantial, my variance of fitness in the population is large. You can get away with some of the arguments of sort of doing mean field arguments, and so you treat this in the spectrum of all the others, and then you sort of work out self-consistently. So the one you're interested in. Now you have to worry by the fact that it's Gaussian, the distribution, but it's not Gaussian far enough out sometimes. You have to look at the fact that the ones you really care about are the atypical things that are far enough out in the tail that you can't just use Gaussian results. But there's actually quite a wide range where you can. But there's a whole lot of sort of self-consistent checks that you have to do. Okay, but I think at least there's well-defined regimes in which the results I'm running down are asymptotically correct again. Okay, but I at this point don't understand entirely which the regimes are. Okay. So in this case, you actually do even better. So here, V goes as 2 log mn, okay? So R squared, okay? So here the S is also dropped out. And here, actually, if you want to have an S dependence of some function of R over S times square root of log mn. Okay, so there you've got a square root of log coming in. Again, it's a correction, okay? But it's a much bigger correction than this one here. from the fact that you have S's. So basically the time scales are so dominated by the R's because they're what's giving you all the shuffling up and down. Okay, and the difference in S, you know, it's not a hell of a lot. Okay. So it's you know, it's sort of surprising. Okay. Now, the more realistic case is already I mean, I understand much less about it and say this my betting odds on are lower, but I'm pretty sure it's right. Okay. So we want to somehow balance how long linkage lasts. So if I do a realistic case, and you know, the simplest model of that is I've got here's one organism, here's another one. Okay, I take these organisms, I cut the chromosome at some random point. Okay, so I've got this one like this. Okay, and I recombine these to make the two possibilities, which are this genome on one half and the other genome on the half, and the other one. Okay. And then I randomly put this around the chromosome, so you know, it's nice and symmetric and so on. Okay. This case is much, much harder. I mean, it's to really analyze things. But a crucial part is the fact that I stay linked with things that are nearby much longer than I stay linked, which are things far away. Okay? And the linkage nearby is even worse, right? Because you're hanging on to these guys nearby, so the chance of hanging on, sticking with guys that are bad, is pretty high. Unless you have two recombinations which are very near each other, right? So if you have a recombination here and a recombination there, then of course you're separating out from other guys and joining someone else. So there's some chance of having some recombination which separates you, some chance of not, and I say it gets very complicated. Okay. The however, here an issue does come in, which is how long many recombinations do you have to end up with a given amount that you're linked with still. So here, as time goes on, you lose an amount of fitness by being linked. So the fitness loss of being linked goes as t log t in time. Goes as t log t. So you keep your linkage keeps getting worse and worse, but of course that's your typical one. You have some offspring who happen to do better in the mating game, and they're linked less, and the ones that are really lucky are the ones that'll take over. Okay, but typically the effects of linkage then are bad. Okay. So what happens in this case? Well, I believe that the answer that happens in this case is that v goes as s times r times log n. Okay, I said that's of course, dimensionally, I can have any combinations of S's and R's here. So this case, it does depend upon S. This is, you know, much more realistic, getting closer to realistic cases. And you get this. If you start just asking how big does N have to be before you start getting these effects coming in, that's sort of consistent with this as well. So this is roughly speaking true when N is bigger than let me do this right away. Nm is bigger than of order r over s. So I want to look at the number of mutations produced during the time that I stay linked. Okay. So this has to be bigger than sort of r over s times log of something, probably, instead of being bigger, better one. Okay. So this is true for r much bigger than s. But it's something like this, and this is the condition, so you have larger n where the basic picture still works. Not surprisingly, you're chopping up the genome, right? So things that aren't linked for very long, like things over here and over there, are sort of independent. It's only things that are near each other that aren't independent. And this is roughly the crossover criteria, and then if you ask, well, how fast you're going there and so on, you can get things like this, but you can also try to do the argument carefully at this end and get out something. So I think this is probably right, but I won't bet on it.
This still has nm in the log?
Whether you put m's in this log, it doesn't really matter much because n's of order 1, and that's
the first line. N is
this one.
Log n or log nm?
Okay, this is for large n, so the difference between them is order 1. It's probably log nm comes in again. It's basically, you don't need much sex to make nm come back to being the real variable again, even though you get... So if you look in here, basically here I've already got logs, as of r, I've already got mn coming in, and that's true even before s gets r gets to be exponentially bigger than s. And so you quite quickly cross to doing that. Okay. So a simple problem, which I've been struggling with for the last few weeks, is a much simpler one than this. Is I just say I've got two chromosomes. Okay, so I've got two chromosomes, so this is the even simplest model. I've got two chromosomes, I've got, say, one big one and one small one, if you like, just to show them as being different. Well, let's do this in a square one, triangular one, I don't know. Okay, and I'm taking, so my organism's got both of those, and I'm going to take my other one and recombine from another, the one from another organism and combine with the triangle. Okay, so I'm just going to exchange, split the chromosomes up. I'm not going to have any recombination within, I'm just going to divide the chromosomes up when I mate.
Okay. This would be like two loci with many, many alleles.
Like two loci with very many alleles, right? Right. This case, I think I must be being particularly stupid again, but this one is, embarrassingly hard. Okay. And so far, I think I have five different ranges of R where things change, and how you sort of put them. It's not where just things change because again, I'm trying to get all the bits right. It's figuring out which are really the important ones. Okay. And so figuring out, so here these are both evolving asexually, but then they're recombining. If the recombination rate is very high, right, then it just evolves at twice the rate. If the recombination rate is zero, it's just a bigger chromosome, it's like having a higher mutation bracket of two, it hardly makes any difference at all. Right? If these two are completely linked, it only evolves slightly faster, because that's just a total mutation rate, then logarithmically faster than it did before. Otherwise it evolves a factor of two. Right? So this already has a big change. There are lots of sexes of factor of two better, as far as the speed. Okay? Where you start really crossing over from one of those to the other, I'm not even sure. I think it may be when little r is of order a power of 1 over the population size. I think that it may be that you need very little sex to unlink these sufficiently. But if that result was right, it's very weird. And I don't think that one I wouldn't even give even odds on. This one I'll give substantial odds. And those ones over there, yeah, much more substantial odds. Or at least as far as the R squared and log n and the coefficient still subject to manipulation.
So how well does the right hand sides of all these little expressions for V correspond to the variance of fitness?
So all of these cases, the variance of fitness satisfies is V. All of these cases. As long as there is a lot of selection going on, the variance is going to be V. It doesn't, in the sequential thing, it doesn't work, right? But once you've got a lot going on, the variance is V. And then it tells you how useless that is, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because everything is dominated by the rare things, and the variance only tells you what happens a very short time. Right? It tells you what happens as you go through a few standard deviations, maybe. Okay. This paper, which Dawkins said such nice things about, and I was implicitly saying nasty things about by saying nasty things about Dawkins, was that the basically assumes that you can just keep evolving on standing variation for up to, I estimated it last night, what was it, it depends on how you count the variables, but basically more than 20 standard deviations away from the mean. In fact, it's enough standard deviations if you just estimate how big a population would you need, assuming it was really Gaussian, which effectively they're assuming it's Gaussian all the way out, and how long you need, the population size you would need was of order either 100, not the time you would need, the population size you would need. So it's a big number that comes in, and that happens to be too big a number, okay, much too big a number for. But the answer they conclude is that you can produce a vertebrate eye in 100,000 years. But I say the calculation is totally irrelevant. I mean, for biological reasons, it's also irrelevant. But the fact that, and this is collected in various books, this is being relevant for evolution. And I say Dawkins seems to think that it solves the quantitative problem, which I personally find embarrassing. But I should turn the mic off. Okay.
So non-recombination doesn't decrease the diversity at a locus because if you just swap two things over, like in this side of the
right.
Then, right. Then you move an allele from one place to another. So the copy numbers of the alleles don't change.
The total copy numbers of the alleles don't change, but the distribution does because this is you have now four possibilities of who's linked with who. Right.
So, but on the other hand, if I understand what you're doing over there, I'm interested in that case over there because
yeah.
I think what you're doing is you're changing only one chromosome. You're
changing one allele at a time.
Making a copy of an allele from somewhere and replacing the old one in one individual by this, right? So therefore, that does decreases the diversity of the locus because if you kept you that would lead to fixation of alleles at one locus, right? If I understand what you've done properly.
No, eventually the alleles, some of the alleles in the locus will fix anyway. Most of them will die out, but occasionally they'll fix.
But this has a different. This would fix only by the recombination.
No. No, if I didn't have any sex there, then these will fix. I mean, they're
but for a different reason. For the
no, not fundamentally different reason. I mean, how they're linked is different, but there's no.
So are you doing what I think you're doing? You're just saying.
I think not.
At any one point in time, there's a probability that the allele in my one individual is replaced by some copy of a random member, right?
Well, no, it's not a copy. It's not a copy. It's a. Let's think of it this way around. So there's a death process. Okay? So there's a death process which is, you know, slow compared to a generation. Okay? So with R per generation, an organism can die, and then its alleles go into someone else. Okay? So I think what you think is that I'm doubling the number of copies of the alleles when I do this. I'm not. I'm keeping the number of alleles the same when I recombine it. I mean, the numbers of that of the individuals of those alleles the same.
That are replaced by these alleles that you have moved.
They go to somewhere else. That's just they go to another one. I'm switching to alleles, if you like.
But the transformation probably comes from some floating about bit of DNA that's not really in the population anymore, right?
Okay, but then I can just say it dies. Something dies, and there's a pool of DNA which is produced by dying things which can get picked up.
So the point is that when the event happens, it only changes the recipient. Change the donor.
Change the donor if the donor died?
The donor is not even in the model anymore. Because the donor is...
No, they're all in the model. Okay. I mean, there's these questions again of how fast things are happening relative to the generation time as to when you think of how you think of the death and birth processes and you think of this process, right? So this, I'm assuming these processes are all rare compared to the generation time. If they're the same as the generation time, then I have to, you know, more carefully think about those things. But it doesn't start, I think it still doesn't fundamentally change it, okay? So there's a pool of them, and how they get from one to another doesn't matter. The only crucial thing is that, or matters some, but the only crucial part is that you can replace your allele you've got with one from a random distribution of the same, you know, the same locus in the rest of the population, and you can, you know, then move over to another one. So if you just think of swapping, right? If I just think of doing the recombination by swapping.
The swapping is different to replacing what?
It's not. The swapping is equivalent in this limit. Okay. If I think what you're saying is I have to kill one of them and therefore double one and kill the other in the recombination process, and I'm not doing that.
Kill one because there's already lots of dead ones from the previous generation anyway.
Right. And so those ones are the ones you're picking up.
Yes. In which case, then the event changes the recipient. It changes one individual in the population. And that's different from this. I think it's different in an interesting way. I'm saying that would be a good model to look at.
That gives a factor of two or something like that. It doesn't really change. I mean, it's like the difference between Wright-Fisher dynamics, where you take one out and do something and then put one back right away, and you call that one step. Whether you call that one step or two steps, it's similar kind of difference. Because the other individual has a chance of picking one up that was the one from a guy similar to you. If you're down to the stage where you only have one copy of the allele in the whole population, you know, that's when, again, it starts making a difference. But if the selective advantages are small, those don't make any difference anyway. They're going to die out.
It's obviously that we normalize drift, and we're assuming that drift is rather unimportant anyway, is it?
No, drift is very important when you have, at the very initial, when you put it in. Even here, it doesn't matter. I mean,
but these are not recombinated.
Sorry?
The recombination, the importance is what outcome does the recombination event have, but not what guys go in there. So the parents... They are not drift dominated, but the offspring are.
Okay,
that kind of recombination causes drift.
Yes.
But swap it crossing over doesn't cause drift.
Okay. Oh, okay. That's what you were about. But drift is totally negligible.
Yeah.
But that could be you just reintroduced it in an interesting way.
But I said it's negligible. It's negligible. I introduced it, but it's negligible. For large n, right? Or everything happens much, much faster than times of order n. So drift never matters.
You're sort of arguing in a deterministic way, I think.
No. If it was deterministic, then everything would fix rapidly. Stochastic is absolutely crucial. Okay, but the stochasticity does not come from drift. The stochasticity comes, well, it does to some extent when populations get low. But the stochasticity comes from once a allele has a substantial number in the population, not a substantial fraction, once it has a substantial number in the population, okay, then the only kind of the stochastic things that matters is this stochasticity through the hitchhiking with good and bad other alleles. And the stochasticity of drift only matters when you're very small numbers of the population, which of course then is a tiny fraction for these large ends. I mean, can add in some of the other effects, and they'll change things, but they'll change things very little until either you start, say, recombining for every generation, in which case you have to think much more, of course, about the dynamics, I think, as you're saying, or your population sizes get down to maybe some weird intermediate limit where some of these effects come in, but you still have drift. But but in practice, since the drift always takes time of order n, okay, everything is going on much, much faster than that. I mean, many orders of magnitude faster than that, right? So it's
regarding that model, also, if you look at an allele which has a selective advantage of S, say, what's the probability of fixing in this model?
Exponentially small. You can work it out from the expression, right? Because V is just M N S times the fixation probability, right? So you just work that out from what it is from there.
It goes like 1 over S?
It goes like 1 over N. It goes like log N over N. So this goes like log N over N in. Right, and it has a 1 over S in it, right.
So it decreases if it fits
there? Okay. If I have a distribution of S's, then it increases with your own S, but decreases with the other guy's S's. Right? Because the bigger the other guy's S's are, the more they're fluctuating around, and the bigger these drafting effects are. Okay, so the more rapidly you'll get driven extinct by those fluctuations. If your S increases, okay, so you can ask, okay, what if I have a distribution of S's, how does this change? Now, of course, the fact that this isn't dependent on S anyway means it won't. But I can ask explicitly, this is what I compute. Okay, so the thing, how you do this is you get out, and how you get away from all the difficulties of dealing with recombination normally. Okay, because there are so many other alleles in the population, okay, say particularly for this process, I say the other one, the free recombination is easier. For this process here, you can say what I do is I follow the distribution of, or the number, for the number of individuals where with the allele which is fitted by S. Okay, I don't want to just follow that number, but I have to follow this number, which is now a function, it's a whole distribution on what it's linked to. Okay, so this is linked to the whole rest of the chromosome. So I've got the phi of the rest that it's linked to. So this is the fitness of it. So its total fitness is phi plus s. I'm more precisely phi minus phi bar is drawn from the distribution of all the other fitnesses going on, and then you have to do the whole thing self-consistently. Okay, but it's a mean field approximation which should be valid in the limit of at least large log n's. Okay, now I say making convincing case is probably hard for it, or completely convincing case. But the reason why I can say make progress is you really can consider each allele in the distribution of the effects of all the others. And I say the things you have to worry about are particularly that it's those bits of the distribution that only depend on a few others that really matter. They typically don't depend on many others; they only depend upon log n others. So I mean, again, these are sort of things that are asymptotically right in logs. Okay, but I don't care about that. I mean, I care about the logs in the sense that their logs are slow functions. Okay, but to being asked only writing logs, I don't care about. I mean, the behavior here is completely different. It's qualitatively different, right? And so the fact that it's a log, or if it was a log squared or so on, I mean, it makes some difference. Logs are pretty big numbers here, but not enormously. But the crucial part is some sense that the fixation probability is of order 1 over n. Right? I mean, it happens to be log n over n, but it's the 1 over n. You're extremely unlikely to fix beneficial mutation. But your beneficial bounce up and down in the population. Okay, in fact, you can... Right, in the asexual case, that's already true. In the asexual case, if you look at a given allele coming in, you can also do it that similar way. So, and you can look at the fate of a new mutant coming in the population. Because it can come in anywhere. It doesn't have to come in at the nose. It's most likely to fix if it comes in the nose. So then you can follow its distribution and what happens to it as to where it is. And you'll find even ones that come in near the nose will bounce up and down. And the distribution of them in the population you can work out. And it's somewhat different than... the normal case, the distribution of the alleles at frequency f in the population is something like 1 over f to the 1 plus 1 over q, 1 minus f to the 1 minus 1 over q, and down to a very small f at which this changes, some form from small f that it changes. Okay. So it has a 1 over f, 1 minus f, which is very characteristic of the steady state, if you have with neutral drift. Okay, but it's got small corrections to that coming from the process. And then I think it's not some comment of the day. There is an effective, like, diffusion process when the frequency is substantial by which these beneficial alleles are bouncing up and down. Okay, but it's a very fast one because of these sort of low effective population sizes. But it still is there, and that's basically why you still get this 1 over F into 1 minus F coming in. Okay, now part of that comes from the fact that the transitions where individual ones are sweeping also gives you 1 over F into 1 minus F. So in some ways, there's deviations from that that one needs to needs to understand. But it's some.
In the asexual case, do we have any chance of fixing URI is not in the fittest class?
Exponentially, well, if exponentially small, I mean, it's not like exponential. It goes as e to the minus. If you go away from the fittest class by an amount delta, it goes as something like e to the minus. Delta log delta. It's faster than exponentially decaying, going away from that. With the all the s's being the same. If the s's are different, then it's a somewhat different result. But it goes off. You're very unlikely to.
Yeah. Again, to this other model, these phis are drawn from a essentially Gaussian distribution, or.
Okay, so this is the essentially Gaussian. In fact, for some of these things, it basically is Gaussian far enough out in the tails. So it's Gaussian to many standard deviations. But the question is it to enough standard deviations to matter? And at least in the things that are estimated carefully, it is in over wide ranges. Okay. So it's Gaussian enough. So then you can again just write a simple stochastic differential equation for this distribution here that is numbers as a function of phi. And it has a part in it, which is the, you know, u getting replaced here. Well, the free recombination is easiest. And it has a part, which of course is just loss rate to the recombination, which is very small. And then you substitute your phi with a random other phi. Right, so it's a simple equation that you write down in that case. And again, you can all the branching process analyses you can do on that. And it's actually not, that's a relatively easy analysis to do.
Multiple copies that can sit on different genomes, so you have to keep track of some collection of phis.
This is the whole distribution of the function of phi. This is a stochastic function of phi. Right? This is a stochastic variable, this whole n. Right? So I have a PDE stochastic, stochastic PDE in this. That doesn't matter. I mean, physicists stochastic PDEs don't bother. I think mathematicians they tend to bother, but you can discretize if you want. Doesn't matter. But it's a stochastic PDE, and you can say, but you can analyze it enough to and basically what you only have to analyze it when this number integrate over phi, right, which is the total number. This is the total number with that s, right? Is this integrate over phi over all the possibilities? As long as this is much less than n. Okay, then the branching process, the fixed n constraint doesn't matter for that allele. Okay, so you can get it all from branching process things without worrying about the total n until it gets up to be half, you know, some fraction of total. But by then it's deterministic and you're out of this fluctuating regime. And so you're safe. You can again match it on and so on. So and I said you can do the ace, it's actually a very instructive way to do the asexual case. In fact, the easiest way to understand the diversity in the asexual case is instead of looking at it from the viewpoint of the number of individuals on one step, you look at it from the viewpoint of a single allele coming in the population. Okay, and the question where it comes in is crucial. And the fact that other alleles are coming in with the same fitness as you are means that just because you came in the fittest one, you can get beaten up by luck by a guy who came in after you did. Right? But whose earlier stages of birth process are lucky. So, or by excessively large numbers of ones that came in later than you. I mean, there's various things, again, that can beat you. And so if you do it from the point of view of an individual allele, it's actually the easiest way to understand what's going on in that case too, and you can sort of tie the two parts together at least with some extra work. Okay, well I almost went 3 hours.